beat goes on, yeah, and the beat goes on, yeah, and the beat goes on.
But the beat goes on.
But the beat goes on.
I always like to keep my favorite snack handy. Feel a little excitement? Step into a Slim Jim. Oh, yeah.
From the Tower of Power, too sweet to be sour, I'm funky like a monkey. Sky's the limit and space is the place. I'm your friend, but if I ever see you in the ring, I can beat you. Don't you know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, Mr. Perfect, you're not perfect. I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect. I'm out of here. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you something right now. I'm going to get you, man. Yeah. I'm going to get you. You haven't been beat up properly. Elizabeth, will you marry me?
We don't have an answer. We don't have an answer.
We didn't ask about it, Miss Elizabeth.
It's okay for macho men to show every emotion available right there, you know, because I've cried 1,000 times, I'm going to cry some more. But I've soared with the eagles, and I've slithered with the snakes, and I've been everywhere in between. And I'm going to tell you something right now. There's one guarantee in life, and that there are no guarantees, yeah. Nobody likes a quitter. Nobody said life was easy, so if you get knocked down, take the standing 8 count, get back up, and fight again, and you're a macho maniac. Dig it.
Truly sad week in the world of professional wrestling. You're listening to episode 160 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. You're on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, May 22nd, 2011. I am the Solid Monster, and we have really three huge stories to talk about here on the show this week, but none bigger than our top story, which, to no one's surprise, is the death of one of the greatest and most popular well-known wrestlers in the history of the business, quite frankly. Randy Macho Man Savage, who passed away on Friday after suffering some sort of episode, believed to be a heart attack, while driving down in Tampa, Florida with his wife, Lynn, and he crashed into a tree and was later pronounced dead from injuries that have not yet been explained at the hospital. He was 58 years old, and this, to me, is certainly one of the biggest, if not the biggest, wrestler death. The Benoit stuff back in 2007 was worse in terms of 3 people were killed, and it was just a horrible time for pro wrestling. But this was just a really bad accident that has had a lot of profound impact on people all over the world. It's actually quite amazing to see the breadth of coverage in the media over the death of Randy Savage, from just mainstream media, sports media, entertainment media. TMZ, I think, was maybe the first website to break the story on Friday. I myself did not find out about the news until I received an email from my brother that I checked after coming out of a business meeting at about 1:15. And it's one of those things where you look at the subject line and it said Randy Savage passes away, and you just sit there and you just say to yourself, no, please no. And just a very, very, very sad story. Police report indicates that he was driving his 2009 Jeep Wrangler, again, down in, it was actually in Seminole, Florida, which is near Tampa, which I believe he may have been living, and suffered some sort of medical event, which again cannot be confirmed until the autopsy has been completed. and he lost control of the vehicle, and it went over a concrete median divider in the road, crossed over the eastbound lanes of traffic, and collided head-on with a tree. And he was transported to Largo Medical Center. I believe his wife, who was also seat-belted into the car with him, suffered minor injuries and has since been released. She was rushed to a different hospital. And obviously we all know the end result. The reason that they believe he suffered a heart attack is, I believe, because his wife had said that she thought he was suffering a heart attack about, you know, a matter of seconds before the crash took place. And who better to know than the person who was sitting next to him? Whether it was that or a seizure or whatever, something happened. There's no alcohol involved, no drugs, nothing like that. And really the only positive here, if there is a positive, is that no one else was killed. And I'm not just talking about his wife, but again, whatever happened to him, he veered off the road across other lanes of traffic, seemingly having no control over his vehicle. And there could have been more loss of life. You know, he could have collided with another car. There could have been a multiple car pileup. He could have, you know, hit somebody with his car on the side of the road. So, thankfully, nobody else was killed. But it's, you know, it's a small positive to what is just a horrible story. I myself, as many of you know, grew up on the World Wrestling Federation in the mid to late 1980s, where Savage really, on a national level, started to really make a name for himself. And was still at that point in the prime of his career. And you think about a lot of the big time wrestlers from that era. You still have Hulk Hogan and, you know, Rowdy Piper and others even from before that, like Billy Graham and Bruno Sammartino, who are still alive. But this is a really big one and a really sad one here. I've been very depressed, quite frankly, about the whole thing. And you know, obviously, for the longest time, and I still get constant questions and emails about, well, you know, is Savage ever going to go into the WWE Hall of Fame, and why won't Vince McMahon bring him back? And just, I would always get questions like that for years. And it's sad now to see that if and when Savage goes into the Hall of Fame, which, again, is a minor thing compared to the greater story here, but he will not be around to see it, and that's a real shame. The story got play pretty much everywhere. Again, I mentioned TMZ, I think, broke the story. The AP ran a story about it. I know on Friday it was being covered by SportsCenter on ESPN, not only during the show, but in the crawl on the bottom of the screen. And there were other shows on the network. And last night, for example, there was an MMA show, Bellator, on MTV2, and the announcers paid tribute to Randy Savage on that show as well. He was truly, in many ways, a cultural icon. In large part because of those Slim Jim commercials that he did in the mid-90s when he was still, you know, in the later portion of his WWF career. And he may have still been doing the Slim Jim stuff early in his WCW run as well. But one thing I wanted to point out here, ESPN put a story up on Friday. They may have just been running the AP story, but I went through the comments section because, like many of you, I was searching for information, just couldn't really get my mind off this story on Friday and was so focused on reading different comments that people were leaving and whatnot. And I noticed that under the article, within a couple of hours of his death being announced, there were nearly 500 comments. And while I'm sure there may have been some smart-ass, sarcastic comments buried in there somewhere, or people who were upset that a story about a fake wrestler was being posted on a sports website, I went through the comments section beneath the article, and post after post after post was nothing but positive about Macho Man and wrestling back in the day. And it's truly a rarity if you've ever taken a gander at the comments sections under stories on most websites these days to see that much positive feedback and very little, if any, negative feedback. And I think it really speaks to what people thought of Savage as a performer. You know, he was a larger-than-life, almost cartoon character that fit in very well in that era of pro wrestling. You know, the raspy voice and the trademark shades and the funny hats and the costumes, which, you know, really only came kind of, I say, in the second part of his career. Early on, especially early on in his WWF run, you know, one of the things that I always loved were his ring robes. You know, the guy must have spent a fortune on them, because I don't remember ever seeing him wear the same wrestling robe twice. It was always something different. As a matter of fact, I think at WrestleMania 4, when he won the championship for the first time and came out for four different matches, I'm pretty sure he came out in four different robes, and Elizabeth herself came out in four different outfits. He was just, you know, very into his character and very good at what he did. I don't think that should be a surprise to anybody. Just to take you back a little bit here, at the beginning of Savage's career, some people I'm sure know this, many people do not, that Randy Savage used to play minor league baseball and really had set his aspirations on becoming a ball player. It was never his goal to become a professional wrestler, even though that was the family business. You know, his father, Angelo Poffo, of course, ran a promotion, the ICW promotion. Savage's brother, Lanny Poffo, who many of you may remember as the Genius, who I think was the person who actually first provided the information to TMZ that his brother had suffered a heart attack and died. He got into wrestling as well, but Savage really wanted to play baseball. And over four seasons that he did play, from 1971 to 1974, starting at the age of 18, he played the position of catcher. And I think his batting average, the average of his batting average over those four seasons was .254, which, if you're a baseball fan, .254, it's okay. He had certainly flashes of greatness. If you look back at his minor league stats, you know, there were a few seasons in particular that he did very, very well. But it was always his goal to be a ball player. And what ended up happening is he actually blew out his shoulder, suffered a shoulder injury. And it wasn't at that point that he got into wrestling. He was still so adamant about being a ball player that he actually learned to throw left-handed, which was not a natural thing for him because he wanted to badly still be a part of the baseball world. And, you know, it just didn't work out, unfortunately. And he got, at that point, into professional wrestling. Now, one interesting little nugget here that, to me, makes the story even more tragic, although it's almost like a circle of life kind of thing. Savage met his current wife, Lynn, who was actually in the car with him when he had his accident on Friday. And again, she suffered minor injuries and was released from the hospital. But he first met his current wife in the 70s, around the time that, you know, he was first starting to play minor league ball. And once he decided to go into pro wrestling after he blew out the shoulder and things just didn't work out, they kind of broke up and went their separate ways. And when Savage began performing in ICW for his father, that's when he met Elizabeth. Elizabeth was actually the television announcer for the ICW promotion at the time, and probably would have been about 18, 19 years old at that time. And they were together for many, many years. Contrary to popular belief, the SummerSlam 91 wedding was not, in fact, their actual wedding. They were first married in 1984, before Savage even came into the WWF. And they got a divorce, ironically, in 1992, which was not all that long after the fake wedding that they had on pay-per-view. That would have been the same year, in fact, that Savage won the title for a second time from Ric Flair. It was within a couple of months that they had gotten a divorce. And anyway, fast forward, and somehow, in the last couple of years, Savage reconnected with Lynn, his first girlfriend from the 70s. And they actually got married a year ago this month, May 10th. They had just celebrated their one-year wedding anniversary. And like I said, circle of life, it's just really, really sad. You know, Savage and Elizabeth, of course, were the big pair in wrestling history. I don't think there'll ever be anybody greater than Savage and Liz, but even when Savage went to WCW and he was legitimately dating, you may remember, Gorgeous George, and I don't mean the wrestler, Savage had a penchant for dating women that were a lot younger than him, as many wrestlers tend to do. And it's, to me, I just look at this and think he must have really finally found some sort of happiness in his life and just kind of mellowed out and settled down because, again, Lynn was, I think she's 56. So she's pretty much the same age almost as Savage was. It wasn't like, you know, she was, 20 years his junior or anything. He found this girl that he had once dated over 30 years ago. They reconnected and got reacquainted. And we're, you know, got married, and we're going to live out the rest of their days together. And then, you know, you read about something like this, and it just, I don't know, just makes you very, very sad. Now, Savage, as far as his early work in the late 70s and the early 80s in the ICW promotion, was just fantastic stuff that I, myself, have only become familiar with in recent years by watching old videos on YouTube. You can go to YouTube right now and find videos of really old Savage promos, including some pretty funny ones of him dressed like a homeless fisherman is the best way I could describe it. He just was wearing this fisherman's hat, and you know, he had the big scruffy beard and the same trademark voice, only it wasn't quite as raspy as it would become in later years. But his promo work, his in-ring work back then was just second to none. I mean, he was one of the best performers probably in the entire country. And as a matter of fact, he was tag team partners for a period of time with Cowboy Bob Orton, who, of course, is the father of Randy Orton. And Savage had a pretty intense feud with Jerry the King Lawler, who, ironically, is actually wrestling tonight as I record this podcast at the WWE pay-per-view. But Savage and Lawler had, I think, a couple of really intense, really good matches back in the early 80s, including at least one steel cage match. There was a lot of politicking back in the day around that period of time. There was some sort of war going on between the Poffo family and the promotion that they ran, which was in direct competition to Jerry Jarrett's promotion, of course, the father of Jeff Jarrett, who was one of the famous wrestling promoters of our time. And for people who must be thinking to themselves, why did it take so long if Savage was so good as early as the 70s for him to get noticed and picked up by a major wrestling company like he did in 1985? Well, the reason is politics. You know, that's really what it boils down to. There was a back in the day, you had a lot of different wrestling territories and a lot of wrestling promoters. It was just completely different than it is today. And there were a lot of promotions who were at war with one another. Some could coexist peacefully, others could not. And the fact that Savage's family were running in direct competition to the Jarretts did not make people in the National Wrestling Alliance very happy. And it just had a lot to do with that. Were it not for that, Savage probably would have gone to the NWA first, and it could have changed the course of wrestling history. You know, who knows if he would have ended up in the WWF when he did. Probably not. But as it turned out, Savage did come to the World Wrestling Federation, I believe in 85. They ran an angle, which again, you could find a video of on YouTube, of you know, different managers courting him, and there was one episode of WWF television where he finally introduced his new manager, and it wasn't any of the existing managers in WWF that were vying for his services, but it was this beautiful woman named Elizabeth, his real-life wife, and she was just gorgeous. And to me, Elizabeth always represented class in wrestling. Whatever her actual background was, you know, and the rumors of different things and whatnot, the character that she portrayed on television is one that you don't often see in wrestling. You certainly didn't see it a decade ago in the Attitude Era, when every woman, you know, had their big boob jobs and they were all walking around like trashy sluts. And it's not all that different today, to be honest with you. But she really was the picture of class. You know, she would come out wearing these beautiful gowns and these beautiful dresses, and she always just seemed very shy and just very quiet and reserved. But Savage and Liz, Savage was very talented, and I'm sure he would have gotten over and become a big star no matter what. But Elizabeth, I don't think, gets enough credit sometimes for really being part of the package that put Savage over the top. It was the two of them together that allowed them to become as successful as they were when he came over to the WWF. And Savage, in short order, was really, you know, rising up the ranks. He won the Intercontinental Championship, had some great matches with Tito Santana. And, of course, WrestleMania 2 was his first WrestleMania. He had what I, you know, it was pretty much a throwaway match with George the Animal Steel. Although the storyline there was actually very well done in terms of here's, you know, George Steel, you know, this bumbling buffoon who has become infatuated with Miss Elizabeth, and he's, you know, she has become the object of his affection. And that was really the whole kind of crux of their feud. The matches they had pretty much sucked. WrestleMania 3, though, you can't really say that. WrestleMania 3, of course, was probably Savage's most famous match, and arguably his best. It was the culmination of the feud with he and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, And, of course, the big angle that put this whole thing over the top, which came a couple of months before WrestleMania in 1987, was the incident on, it was either Superstars or Wrestling Challenge, where Savage attacked Steamboat by coming off the top rope and smashing the ring bell. I believe it was across his back, which then knocked Steamboat's throat into the metal barricade, or perhaps he came down directly on his throat with the bell. Regardless, it was a huge angle. I mean, just a hugely impactful angle at the time. And I remember when I was a little kid, watching this, thinking to myself, the guy can't breathe. He's going to die. He can't breathe. I mean, they put Steamboat on a gurney and were taking him through the aisleway. And again, back then, the aisleways were a lot more narrow. You know, fans were able to really just kind of reach out and touch the wrestler. And here's this image. They have an overhead camera shot of all these WWF officials carrying Steamboat out on a gurney as the fans kind of reach out and they're just touching him. And he's clutching his throat. And I just am mortified watching this on TV, thinking, this poor guy can't breathe. Somebody help him. He's gonna die. It was a huge angle. Steamboat, of course, came back. They had the match at WrestleMania. I think I may have mentioned this before, but the thing about that match is that Savage was the one who put that whole match together. They both deserve a lot of credit for pulling it off, but Savage was either very paranoid about, not having the best match on the show or whatever the case may be. I don't remember too many other stories of Savage doing this, but he scripted that match out move for move. And him and Steamboat were going over the spots and the sequences in that match for months leading up to WrestleMania. He would randomly call out spots. I think he would assign numbers to them, I remember hearing, and would quiz Steamboat just to make sure that he remembered everything. And, to me, I'm not a wrestler, so who am I to say, but to me, I think the best matches usually are done on the fly with two people in the ring who know what they're doing. You have a loose idea of what you want to do. You go in there and you wing it. And this was the one example that I could think of a match that was anything but done on the fly. And who can argue that it wasn't one of the greatest matches of all time? I mean, they pulled off just a tremendous match, easily the show-stealing match at WrestleMania 3. It's still remembered to this day. Countless wrestlers have said that that was the one match that really got them into professional wrestling in the first place. And that really, I think, helped put Savage on the map. A year later, of course, actually, back up a little bit here. Later on that same year is when the Savage babyface turn began to take shape. And this was where the mega powers came into play. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. The entire mega powers angle, from start to finish, which had allegedly been the brainchild of Elizabeth, as the legend has it, it was her idea to do that storyline where the two of them would become friends, they would become partners, ultimately kind of torn apart by jealousy over Elizabeth herself. And it was probably one of, if not the greatest angle ever done by Vince McMahon and WWF. Not because it was just great, which it was, and the payoff at the end was huge, but it carried over for over a year. Think about it. The Mega Powers formed in the summer, I believe, of 87. And didn't, quote, explode until early 89, which led to the WrestleMania 5 match. Just a phenomenal angle. Savage, of course, went to WrestleMania 4, wrestled four times in one night, became the WWF champion in the single elimination tournament. And you may have heard the story about him and Honky Tonk Man clashing over the Intercontinental Championship, and Savage was supposed to get the Intercontinental belt back. Honky Tonk Man did not want to do the job, not because he had anything against Savage, but he just felt that it wasn't the right time to drop the belt, and Savage was not happy about this. And to appease him, Vince McMahon gave him a victory in the WrestleMania 4 tournament. I've heard it enough times where I'm sure that is the story, pretty much, how it went down. I've heard Honky, I've heard Savage, I think, in interviews, DiBiase, they've all vouched for it. I just find it hard to believe that the original plan was to put the belt on Ted DiBiase, and they would have ended WrestleMania with a heel winning this big tournament to become world champion. Because back in the day, that just, even these days, they don't like having the bad guy kind of win at the end of WrestleMania. Although they did it this year with The Miz, but then again, they had The Rock lay him out at the end of the show. But regardless, it all worked out in the end for Savage, I think we can all agree, because he became the champion. And You know, he went on to have a very successful year-long reign as the champion. Probably could have gone longer with it, too. The house show business that he did that summer in 88 with DiBiase was hot. I mean, just hot as hell. And, of course, fast forward to the following year, February of 89, they did the big breakup angle. They did that match on the main event, Mega Powers against the Twin Towers. Elizabeth took a big bump during that match. Savage got thrown out of the ring, and he just, I mean, he just smacked Elizabeth and landed right on top of her. And Hogan, of course, comes over, carries her to the back, leaving his partner in the ring to get his ass beaten. Hogan comes back out, gets slapped by Macho Man, who deserts him. They did the big angle after the match backstage, where Savage attacks Hogan. That was the earliest, one of the earliest angles I remember. And for years, in the early and mid-90s, I was desperately looking for footage of that angle. Because I knew that we had recorded it on a VHS tape, and it was either lost or it was erased over. And this very, very much upset me. And back in the day, there was no YouTube. There were no online streaming services. You know, WWE didn't put its video library out there on demand like it does these days. I could not find footage of this angle for years, and it upset me greatly because it's one of the angles I remember most fondly from my childhood. And, of course, now you can easily find that footage all over the place, and I've probably seen it about 500 times. Just really, really well-done stuff. And, you know, one of the things I have to mention is that, ironically, over the last couple of weeks, I've asked you guys to send me stories, to email me with stories on how you first became fans of pro wrestling. You know, how did you become a fan? When did it happen? What was your earliest wrestling influence? And, first of all, a common thread amongst all of these stories involves the Macho Man, ironically enough. Many people listening to this show right now probably first became wrestling fans, if your stories are any indication, because Savage was the or one of the performers that you remember most earliest in your wrestling fandom who really helped bring a lot of fans into professional wrestling, whether it was his, you know, flashy character or his matches, whatever the case may be. Macho Man is one of the reasons that people listening to this podcast right now became wrestling fans in the first place. And if you were to ask me what my earliest wrestling memory was of being at a live event, my very first live event, in fact, I think was a house show. I want to say it was Madison Square Garden. And the main event, this would have been around 87, the main event of that show was Honky Tonk Man defending the Intercontinental Championship against Randy Savage. And in a little shark cage, hanging above the ring, was Honky Tonk Man's manager, Jimmy Hart. And that's the earliest live event wrestling memory that I have. It was an Intercontinental title main event with Jimmy Hart in a cage and Savage wrestling. And I don't remember who won. Obviously, Honky Tonk Man did not lose his title. And I think they've replayed this match, actually, in one of the house show cards on 24/7. They've shown it at least once or twice in recent years. That's my earliest live event wrestling memory, and it involves the Macho Man. But anyway, his year-long title reign was very successful, and it culminated in WrestleMania 5, lost the championship to Hogan in what, up to that point, had been the biggest pay-per-view, buy rate that the company had ever done. A lot of people saw that show. And then Savage kind of dropped a little bit lower down the card, and I'm not quite sure why, because his star was still shining very brightly. You know, he did go on to continue to main event most of the time in 89. You know, SummerSlam that year, it was him and Zeus against Hogan and Beefcake. But they saddled Savage with the Macho King gimmick, which I used to love the Macho King. I look back on it now, and it's kind of silly that they stuck a crown on his head. I think he was, you know, he was deserving of more than that. And I almost feel like they kind of marginalized his character by doing that. But I used to love the Macho King character, that whole gimmick. And he feuded for a time with Dusty Rhodes. Of course, he picked up Sensational Sherry as his manager for actually quite a while. Another wrestling legend who is no longer with us. And I mentioned earlier that Savage Steamboat is probably the most successful, the most famous match of his career. But you'd have to also make the argument that WrestleMania 7 is way up there. Because Savage went out and did something that was very difficult to do. He went out there And not only did he get a good match out of the Ultimate Warrior, who, in fairness, Warrior did have some pretty damn good matches. I won't give him all the credit for it. He deserves some of the credit. His match with Hogan at WrestleMania 6 was nothing short of a miracle. You had two guys that were not known for being great workers, per se, go out there and shock the world with as good of a main event as they were able to pull off. Warrior had some pretty good matches with Rick Rude as well. I wasn't a huge fan of their WrestleMania 5 match, but the Warrior-Rick Rude match from SummerSlam in 89 is one of my favorite SummerSlam matches, and in my opinion, one of Warrior's best. But Warrior's greatest match, easily, was WrestleMania 7. I refuse to believe any different. You cannot possibly make the argument that Warrior had a better match than he did there. And I'm a huge fan of that WrestleMania 6 match with Hogan, but this was better. The feud was Savage and Warrior. Warrior had lost the championship because of Savage's interference at the Royal Rumble in 91 when he smacked him in the head with a royal scepter. Why would he do that? Well, Savage wanted to get the next title shot, and Warrior said, I'm not giving it to you. So Savage basically just said, fuck you, I'm going to cost you the belt. And that's what he did. And that led to a retirement match at WrestleMania 7. It was career against career. And the story behind this, Savage was looking to take some time off with Elizabeth so they could potentially start a family. And presumably, Savage could get off some of the chemical crap that he was probably on at the time, as many people were. Probably best to clean out your system and get all that crap out of your body if you want to reproduce and have a child. And unfortunately, that never happened. Savage never did have a child that we're aware of anyway. He never was able to start a family with Elizabeth or anybody, really. But that was really the impetus for that stipulation. Savage knew he was taking time off. I don't think the expectation was ever that his career was truly going to be over. But he did lose, and he was gone. He was out of the ring for several months in 1991. And again, that WrestleMania 7 match was just unbelievable in every conceivable way. It was not the greatest match I've ever seen, but it was a fantastic match. And it wasn't just the match. It was the post-match that really put it over the top. I've said on this podcast before that one of my all-time favorite wrestling moments, all-time favorite wrestling moments, was the Randy Savage-Elizabeth reunion after that match was over. I mean, keep in mind, Savage and Liz were on television from the beginning of his career in WWF. They were together for years. The whole Mega Powers angle, everything. And then they finally split. So they had many, many years of being together and being an item on camera. And then they went their separate ways. Savage was with Sherry for a couple of years. So the story had been built up for many, many years. It's the sort of thing that you can't do these days. You can't do that, unfortunately. But there was so much history there that when these two people got in the ring and hugged and reunited, I'm not ashamed to say that that angle brought tears to my eyes. I still watch it sometimes, and it's like, why can't we see storytelling like that today? What's so difficult about that? People were crying. People were standing on their feet, clapping, men, women, everybody. It was just unbelievable. It was one of my favorite WrestleMania moments of all time. It was just so incredibly well done. And in a blink of an eye, Savage went from being a hated heel for many years back to being a babyface, even though it was kind of weird. He was doing announcing for many months after he lost this match. And at least in the first few months of him doing the announcing with Piper and Vince McMahon, he was still kind of portraying the role of heel announcer. So I don't know what that was all about. But he was turned babyface in an instant at WrestleMania 7, and the people were going nuts for him. And as I mentioned, Savage was out of action for many months, and they wanted to get him back into the mix. And how did they do that? Well, they started an angle with Jake the Snake Roberts. And wouldn't you know, here's another one of my all-time favorite angles. You see a common thread here in terms of these matches and moments. A lot of my favorite matches and moments happen to involve Randy Savage. I don't think that's any coincidence. Jake Roberts was a big babyface at the time. And in the summer of 91, Jake Roberts essentially turned on the Ultimate Warrior, which made him a villain. And the plan was to have a Warrior-Jake feud. And they say in life that things happen for a reason. And this is one of those times that I really think things happen for a reason. Warrior had a disagreement over money with Vince McMahon. You know the story. Backstage, SummerSlam 91, after the match, he gets fired, or he quits, depending on who you believe. And he's gone from the WWF. So this kind of leaves Jake Roberts in limbo. And they filmed an angle. SummerSlam 91 is when Savage and Elizabeth had their on-air wedding. And they did an angle after the wedding that they showed on the syndicated programming the following week of their post-wedding reception. So, of course, it's this almost like a catering hall type of deal. And they've got a band performing, and you see a lot of the WWF guys and agents. You see J.J. Dillon on camera at one point, who was working for Vince McMahon at the time. And everyone's just kind of, you know, standing around. The music is playing. They're having a grand old time. And then they go to open the gifts. And Elizabeth opens one of the gifts, and out of the box comes a King Cobra. Undertaker comes out of nowhere. Undertaker just aligns himself with Jake Roberts for whatever reason. Undertaker comes out of nowhere and clocks Savage with an urn, knocking him out. Meanwhile, Elizabeth is on the ground just cowering in fear from this snake. Jake Roberts is over, and he's waving the snake in her face. And Sid Justice actually came to the rescue here. And the plan, again, was for Sid to feud with Jake Roberts. And what ended up happening is Sid suffered a bicep tear. He got hurt. Couldn't wrestle. So this necessitated the in-ring return of Savage, which led to one of the all-time famous incidents on Superstars, which was the snake bite. Randy Savage was on commentary, and Jake Roberts had just won a squash match, and he goaded Randy Savage to leave the announce table and come down to the ring, which was a big mistake. Savage got attacked. He got tied up in the ropes. And Jake Roberts at the time, who was not toting Damien the Snake anymore. You know, Damien was his python that he carried around for years. Now he had a smaller but more vicious King Cobra, which I got to tell you, that King Cobra was probably the creepiest looking snake I've ever seen. It really was. And no more so than on this day, because what happened was, of course, with Savage tied up in the ropes, the snake latched onto his arm, started gnawing on his arm. Now, they had defanged the snake, but the snake still had its regular teeth. It had been, of course, you know, devenomized, but it was always a nice laugh to hear Vince McMahon on commentary talking about the poison, you know, seeping through the veins of the Macho Man and all this stuff. Just quite comical. But I tell you what, for that period of time, you know, you can make the argument that that was the first PG era of the WWF, and it's certainly not something you would see on TV now. That angle was really brutal. I mean, you have this real snake gnawing away on someone's arm. You know, it drew blood. Savage's arm was bleeding. People at ringside were just crying and going nuts. Roddy Piper ran down to the ring. Elizabeth ran down to the ring. Everyone's just freaking out. Savage, of course, is just flailing all over the place, pretending, I guess, like he's, you know, he's just been poisoned. Can't support his own weight. He gets carried off, and I'll never forget this image of Jake Roberts kind of kneeling down in the corner, watching all this carnage as they wheel Savage off on a gurney. And they had this camera shot of Jake kneeling in the corner, and in front of him was the snake. And the snake, well, snakes don't have legs, but the only way I could describe it is that the snake was standing upright, or sitting upright, all on its own. It's just sitting there, staring down the aisleway. It truly creeped me out. I watch that now, and that snake creeps me out. And of course, the story is that 12 days later, that same snake died. And Savage had joked over the years that it was actually he who was poisonous, and he poisoned the snake. So, one of my all-time favorite angles. And really, the whole storyline with Savage and Jake Roberts, in my opinion, was untapped potential, because it really only lasted a couple of months, if that. They could have done so much more. I for one, don't understand why WrestleMania 8... There's a lot of questions about WrestleMania 8, why they announced Hogan versus Flair, and then they changed their mind about it, because they actually did announce Hogan versus Flair. It wasn't until mid-February, actually, that... they did this angle where President Jack Tunney decided that he would switch up the main event, and he made it Savage and Flair for the title and Hogan versus Sid. But I never for the life of me understood why they didn't do Hogan versus Flair, and then underneath it could have blown off the Savage-Jake Roberts feud in a match at WrestleMania. As it turned out, Jake left the company shortly thereafter. Now, I'm sure that was not the original plan. I think Jake, again, had a disagreement with the company and they decided to part ways. But if there was any indication that Jake was on his way out, they could have easily done some sort of loser leaves town match with Savage and Jake. You know, this company ain't big enough for the both of these guys. One guy has to leave. Savage had just lost a retirement match a year earlier. Would he lose another one? Unfortunately, they didn't do that. And the last match that the two of them had on TV, anyway, was a Saturday night's main event match in February of 92 that, if you look at it, for the most part, was almost a squash. I mean, Jake got some offense in, but for the most part, Savage just beat his ass for maybe 10 minutes, if that, and then just pinned him out of nowhere. And that was it. So I always thought that was a little bit disappointing. And you know, of course, after the match, they did the angle where Undertaker turned babyface. You know, Jake was laying in wait. He was going to smack Savage and Elizabeth. Whoever came through the curtain first, he was going to smack them with a steel chair. And as they came through the curtain and Jake wields back, here comes Undertaker out of the corner of the screen, grabbing the chair and saving Savage. And that was the beginning of the Undertaker babyface turn. But I will always look back fondly on the first match that Jake... Actually, I'll tell you what, it goes back even further than that, because Savage and Jake Roberts had a match on Saturday night's main event in 1986 when both of them were heels. That may be the best match I ever saw the two of them have. You know, go on YouTube and find it. It may actually be on the Savage Macho Madness DVD. They had a pretty damn good match back in 86 when, you know, both of them were arguably still in their prime. Fast forward a couple of years, and the first match they had in 91 was in November. They did a, ironically, they did a sample test run, if you will, for a pay-per-view on Tuesday. They were going to try a Tuesday pay-per-view show, which really was only coming about a week or two after the Survivor Series. So think about that. Think about running another pay-per-view immediately after Survivor Series. It doesn't work in 2011. It didn't work in 1991. The pay-per-view flopped, but it was called This Tuesday in Texas. And Savage vs. Roberts had been signed. This may have been Savage's first singles match since WrestleMania 7. And again, it was a very, very short match. I mean, the match, if it went 5 or 6 minutes, that would have been long. I don't think it went longer than that. And Savage just beat Jake out of nowhere. I think he just dropped an elbow on him out of nowhere. 1, 2, 3, and it was over. And again, it was kind of disappointing. But the real story came after the match. Because what happened after the match is that Jake kind of got the better. You know, Randy Savage and Jake were locked in just this blood feud. So even though Savage had just pinned him, he was not finished with Jake Roberts. The assault continued, but Jake got the better of it. And eventually Elizabeth ran down to the ring to protect her husband. And this led to Jake grabbing Elizabeth by the hair, pulling her into the middle of the ring, and slapping her across the face. Think about this. Again, this is 1991 WWF. Arguably the first PG era of WWF. They had just done the snake bite angle, which was very intense and not the sort of thing that they would do. And then they did this. Jake actually laying his hands on a woman. He actually strikes the lovely Elizabeth. I vividly remember Gorilla Monsoon on commentary just flipping out, saying that he should be suspended for life. And I remember after watching that thinking, holy shit, this guy is going to kill Jake Roberts. I mean, he is going to maim him. He's going to tear him to shreds. This was a feud that does not get the credit that it deserves. It was intense. It was real. It was hardcore before hardcore was cool. And it totally didn't fit with what WWF was doing back in 91. This was like an Attitude Era feud, you know, 8 years before its time. And it's still one of my all-time favorite feuds ever in wrestling. And Macho Man, you have to understand something. You know, Macho Man was always a very kind of intense type A kind of personality. You know, anybody who used to watch the Beavis and Butthead TV show, which is coming back soon, by the way. Beavis and Butthead used to go to Highland High School, and the principal was Principal McVicker on the show. And the thing about the Principal McVicker character is they drew lines over him. So, you know, you have the McVicker character illustrated, and they drew these lines above his head because he was always on edge. It was almost like he was always on, like, 6 cups of coffee. You know what I mean? And you saw literally little lines coming over him as though he was always like shaking and he was always wound up about something. And that's kind of what Randy Savage always reminded me of. He would cut promos and if you really looked at him, he would be shaking. You know, he was just a very intense personality. And he really helped put that over the top. Savage can make you believe that if you were his worst enemy and you were on his hit list, then you were up Schitt's Creek without a panel. And again, it's an element of wrestling we don't see very much these days. Everybody is all kind of cookie cutter. Everybody is the same. John Cena is the face of wrestling in 2011. And I don't think there's a person on this earth that takes John Cena seriously when he gets angry. You know, every now and then he'll show flashes of being angry and there's glimpses of it. But when you look at a guy like Randy Savage, I could believe that he really wanted to beat this guy's ass. And I could believe that he could do it. You know, he portrayed a tough guy on TV. By all accounts, in real life, he was nobody that you wanted to mess with either. You know, he was no slouch in real life if you picked a fight with him. But it's just one of those things, again, that makes you look at wrestling today in the modern day, and you don't find people like that anymore. It's just very different than the way it used to be. Anyway, Savage won another WWF title, WrestleMania 8, 1992. I said before, things happen for a reason. They didn't blow off Jake and Savage at WrestleMania, but what we ended up getting was one of the all-time great WrestleMania matches. And Savage won the championship. And again, here's another example of a feud that Savage was thrust into. It was not the original plan. It was the backup of the backup. And the angle that they worked was that Ric Flair had these photographs that were released to WWF Magazine that showed him with Elizabeth. They were, you know, at their home. There was one image of them at poolside looking at each other. There was another one, I think, of Ric Flair petting a horse. They were in a stable somewhere. And the story was Flair would tell Savage that she was mine before she was yours. And heading into WrestleMania 8, Flair and Mr. Perfect were hyping that they were going to unveil to the world this centerfold image of Elizabeth. That after he beat Savage at WrestleMania, they're going to hang this huge centerfold up, and they're going to put it up on the big screen at the Hoosier Dome to show the world. And of course, there was no centerfold. It never happened. But here's Ric Flair telling Randy Savage that your wife belonged to me before she ever belonged to you. And you can just imagine what Savage's reaction to that was. I mean, he came out of WrestleMania 8 a house of fire. And he beat Flair for the championship. And Elizabeth rushes into the corner as Savage is in the corner right after winning the title. He's really just been beaten up, and Liz is kind of tending to him. And Flair, who's wearing a crimson mask, because Flair had gotten had bladed himself during the match, comes over to Elizabeth, spins her around, and proceeds to yell and shout at her, you know, what about me? What about me? And then and Flair goes ahead and plants a wet one on Miss Elizabeth. And this just infuriates her. And it's one of the first times I ever remember Liz getting physical on WWF television with anybody. You know, she had done different spots before where she would, like, trip up Sherry and stuff like that. But she started slapping the shit out of Ric Flair. And then out of nowhere, Randy Savage finally sees what's going on and just launches himself out of the corner, jumps right onto Flair, tackles him to the ground. The place is going ape shit. Referees are in there trying to break it up. Flair, of course, gets the better of Savage. Him and Mr. Perfect are attacking Savage's knee. And it's just a complete melee. It's just absolute chaos. And you knew it wasn't the end. It was just the beginning of that feud. Unfortunately, in many ways, it was kind of the end, because they really didn't have another match on TV until the fall. You know, they went to SummerSlam that year with a Savage Warrior match from Wembley Stadium. And Savage did end up losing the championship to Flair on TV in September of that year. But again, here's another example of, you take something that people can believe in. You know, this is the man's wife. And the one thing you don't want to do is mess with a man's family. And you sure as hell don't want to mess around with Randy Savage's wife. I mean, the stories of him and Elizabeth in the early days when he was in the WWF are infamous in terms of, I've never ever heard a story of Savage lifting his hand to her or being physically abusive, but he was very, very, very overprotective of her, to the point that he would quite literally lock her in the locker room when he would go out for a match. Now, most of the time when he went out for a match, she was with him, but if he was doing anything else, or if he was going to be somewhere else in the arena, he would lock her in the dressing room. And I don't know that it was so much an issue of him not trusting her. I think it was more an issue of, if you think back to what that locker room must have been like in the 80s, with all those big guys and all the, you know, the 80s were a time that were very different from the way things are now. People partied hard. There were a lot of personalities back there that I'm sure would just, you know, grab the first thing in a skirt that they could find. And perhaps Savage just didn't trust the boys. Whatever the case was, he would lock her in the dressing room to protect her from other elements in the dressing room. But regardless, in 92, I mentioned earlier, that's when they got a real-life divorce. And that was something that Savage... That was really the beginning of the bad blood between Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage in real life, because Savage, who had become very good friends, best friends, in fact, with Hogan, and Elizabeth became very good friends with Linda Hogan, and they would hang out a lot. Savage blamed Hulk and Linda for the breakdown of his marriage. I don't know if he was insinuating that they had, you know, almost brainwashed Elizabeth into believing that she could do better than Randy, or whatever the case may be. He harbored a lot of ill will towards the Hogans after that for many years. And years later they would make up, because Hogan is the one who actually got Savage into WCW. You know, the only reason Savage went to WCW when he did and got the sort of contract that he got was because Hulk helped get him in. So they made amends, and they ended up becoming enemies again, and then they were friends, and then they became enemies. And, you know, one of the sad things about what happened on Friday is that Hulk Hogan tweeted, and again, always take Hogan with a grain of salt when he says things. Savage is not here now to corroborate this story, but Hogan claims that he and Savage had just recently, as in the last like couple of weeks or the last few months, began talking again and kind of rekindling their friendship after not communicating for about 10 years, which is easily believable because there was a lot of bad blood. I mean, Savage did a rap album. He did a rap song calling out Hulk Hogan. For years, Savage challenged Hogan to do a match at some independent show, and they would take the proceeds and give it all to charity, and Hogan, of course, never did. But whatever the case may be, Savage and Liz were Splitsville. And I remember reading it in WWF Magazine. That's how I found out they got a divorce. Savage had written some sort of message to the fans, and they actually published it in the WWF Magazine, announcing that him and Elizabeth had grown apart, and they had gotten divorced. And I remember being very surprised by that. And it was around this time that Vince McMahon began phasing Savage out. This was almost like the beginning of the end, even though Savage didn't leave until later in 94. I think it was 93 that really things began to kind of deteriorate, or the writing was on the wall that Savage's time in WWF was probably very limited, because Vince McMahon, around 93, 94, got on this kick that we need to focus on the new generation. We need to focus on the younger talent, which I wish is something that they would, do more of these days. And I think they are, but Savage was a guy that was close to, if not over, 40 years old at that point, and Hogan had already left the company by mid-93. He had left for the final time, and it was out with the old, in with the new. The focus was on guys like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. They were going to be the next generation. And Savage, really, for the most part, was doing announcing for WWF. He was still wrestling, but not nearly as much as he was doing announcing on some of the pay-per-views. He became an announcer on Monday Night Raw. And, Savage, I thought Savage, for whatever it's worth, was actually pretty good. He was not a great announcer. His voice, that kind of gravelly, raspy voice, was not conducive, I think, to being a great wrestling announcer. But he did a fine job at it. He was entertaining more often than not. And he really helped try to put the angles and the guys over. And but the bottom line is that Savage wanted to wrestle more. He knew he had a lot of gas left in the tank, and he disagreed with Vince McMahon. It was a difference of philosophy. And Savage had one last WrestleMania match in 1994, WrestleMania 10 at the Garden. He had a false count anywhere match with Crush, which I used to think was a really cool match, and I go back and watch it now, and it was not one of Savage's best matches. Let's put it that way. But you know, SummerSlam 93, Savage was the master of ceremonies. That was the title they gave him, which basically means we don't know what to do with you, so we're going to just put you out there as the master of ceremonies so you can make an appearance and then go backstage. And I think he was the same thing in 94 at SummerSlam. And by that point, it was obvious that they didn't have any intention of doing things with Savage. Savage had seen Hogan just go to WCW, and Hogan was wrestling Flair and making a lot of money and fighting for the championship. And I'm sure Savage saw that and said, you know what, I could do that too. You know? So it was really just a difference of philosophy. And Savage left the WWF, went to WCW, and that was the last time we ever saw Randy Savage in the World Wrestling Federation. And it's been... it's one of these great mysteries. I said earlier, I still get tons of emails and Facebook posts. What is the deal? What is the beef between Vince McMahon and Randy Savage? And we may never know the real answer to that question, you know. Perhaps the truth died with Savage on Friday, because unless Vince McMahon decides to tell us why, we may never know. You know, there's been a lot of really nasty rumors. You know, one in particular that I believe got started on an old internet wrestling bulletin board in the mid-90s, and it just kind of took off. It's one of those rumors that spreads and people take for the truth that, you know, Savage had sex with or whatever, a young Stephanie McMahon. And I always heard that and thought to myself, you know, if you really stop and think about it, if that had happened and it was common knowledge, first of all, if you're a father, from a fatherly point of view, Randy Savage doesn't live to see another day. If Randy Savage, you know, does anything like that with my young underage daughter, he's a dead man. Plain, pure, and simple. And Vince McMahon is powerful enough that he could have probably made that happen. But the other thing to keep in mind also is this, and Roddy Piper went on Twitter, and Piper was also very broken up about this news when it broke. And Piper had a tweet that he sent out, I think, late on Friday, that it seemed to be something that he thought would put this to bed once and for all, as far as why Vince and Savage had heat. He said that one time in a bar, Savage slapped Vince McMahon. He goes, and there's the answer. And, you know, Roddy was friends with Savage, and he may have been there, and I'm not going to claim to know more than Roddy Piper, but I find that very, very hard to believe. And I don't find it hard to believe that perhaps there was, you know, Savage slapped McMahon in a bar once. Maybe it was they were clowning around or whatever. I could see that happening. But that is not the answer to why Savage was essentially blackballed from WWE all these years. Keep in mind that when Savage left, maybe it wasn't on the best of terms, but when he left, Vince McMahon, I remember on Raw, they came back from commercial break, and Vince McMahon, the camera was on him at ringside, sitting down at the announce table all by himself. And for about 40 or 50 seconds, it was just Vince McMahon staring into the camera, thanking Randy Savage and giving him credit for all of the contributions that he had made to the World Wrestling Federation over the course of his career. It was actually a very, very classy send-off.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have more action for you momentarily. At this time, obviously conspicuous by his absence, is the Macho Man Randy Savage. And I'd like to announce, unfortunately, that Randy Savage has been unable to sign a contract with the World Wrestling Federation, not unable to rather come to terms with the World Wrestling Federation for a new contract. But Randy, I know you're out there listening, and on behalf of all of us here in the World Wrestling Federation, all of your fans, and certainly me, the number one fan, I'd like to say thank you for all of your positive contributions to the World Wrestling Federation. Thank you, Randy Savage, for all of the wonderful memories for so many years here in the World Wrestling Federation. We wish you nothing but the best. Godspeed and good luck.
So if anything bad like that had happened between the two of them, I highly doubt that Vince would have actually taken a minute of precious television time to look into the camera and say the nice things that he said about Randy Savage. So to me, it remains a mystery. I just have assumed over the years that it was some sort of situation where Vince felt betrayed by Savage. You know, he gave him the nice send-off and just decided that, you know what, I don't want to do business with this guy ever again. Savage, you know, people don't realize this, but Savage was really, really kind of ingrained into the WWE brain trust at that time. You know, there's even video on YouTube of Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson, and Randy Savage arriving at a Denny's restaurant after a show one night together. Savage was being brought in, I think, on some of the booking meetings. I think he had actually moved to Stamford, Connecticut for a time because, you know, he wanted to show people that he was really part of the company and he wanted to be a team player. So perhaps, you know, by him jumping to WCW the way that he did, especially if it caught Vince McMahon off guard, which seemingly it did, perhaps that left an impression with Vince of a betrayal that for whatever reason he just simply could not forgive Randy Savage for. And it makes you wonder, you know, all of the guys that came back, all the guys that had a beef with Vince, all the guys that sued Vince, Jesse Ventura once sued Vince McMahon and won. He got brought back. Road Warrior Hawk had nothing but awful things to say about Vince McMahon. And there he was in 2003, just a couple of months before he passed away, wrestling on Raw with Animal against RVD and Kane. Hulk Hogan came back, Bret Hart came back. So why not Randy Savage? It's one of those questions that we'll never know the real answer to, I don't think. Unless Vince McMahon himself wants to come out and tell us, and I don't think he has any real reason to do that, or else he would have. Anyway, Savage went to WCW, and I was not a huge WCW fan at the time. And so I did not see a lot of the work that Savage did, especially pre-NWO. You know, I know he had a feud again. He rekindled his feud with Ric Flair. And ironically, Elizabeth was brought into WCW to be part of that feud. So Savage and Liz, you know, seemingly had no problem working together on camera, even though they were no longer married. Savage, of course, had a whole bunch of matches in WCW with Hogan. He wrestled other people like Sting and Diamond Dallas Page and Lex Luger. And eventually he became a part of the NWO, and you know, as was the case with most guys when they went to WCW, with the potential exception of Hogan, who became very successful and was the top guy there, much like he was in WWF, I feel like in many ways Savage just became another guy. You know, he won a couple of world championships, he was a big-time player, but there's nothing about his WCW run, even when I look back on it now, that really, really stands out to me. I mean, the stuff with Flair was very good. They always seemed to work well together. The matches with him and Hogan still kind of felt like a big deal. And the one thing about Savage that he did do, you know, Savage was a main event guy. He wasn't losing all the time. But he actually really did put DDP over. Diamond Dallas Page became a very big star when he did, in large part because of Macho Man Randy Savage. And Savage gave him a key win, I think, on a pay-per-view at one point. Could have been the pay-per-view maybe where Page won the title for the first time, although maybe not. I think Savage was actually a referee in that match. But regardless, he did a lot to put DDP over when he didn't necessarily have to do it. I think he took a liking to him, saw something in him, and you know, the rest is history. Page became a very big-time player in WCW. So Savage, the thing about Savage is that as great as he was, and he was just awesome. I mean, as a worker, as a wrestler, he was phenomenal. Apparently, even more so before he came to the WWF and presumably started to roid himself up because he was naturally a pretty small guy. He was what I guess you would call a small heavyweight. He wasn't a small guy like a cruiserweight per se, but he was still a heavyweight guy that just wasn't all that big and wasn't all that jacked up. And when he was really light on his feet in the late 70s and the early 80s, like I said, there were very few people in wrestling that were anywhere as good in the ring as Randy Savage. But the style that he wrestled was such that it took a great toll on his knees. I mean, Savage, in almost every match I ever saw him in, would do a couple of things. Obviously, he would come off the top rope for the flying elbow smash, but a lot of times he did this move where he would grab his opponent by the hair or the head and would launch himself over the top rope, and basically just, you know, pull the guy throat first down over the top rope for a hangman. But Savage was putting his own body in great peril by always jumping over the top and landing on the arena floor on his knees. He did another spot in almost every match where he would climb to the top rope and come crashing down with a double axe handle on the outside of the ring, on the concrete floor, onto his opponent. You know, when Savage would leave the ring, if he threw his opponent outside, instead of just rolling out under the bottom rope or climbing through the ropes, he always grabbed the top rope and propelled himself over the top into the floor. And that looks great, and it showed great agility and athleticism on his part, but just imagine the abuse that his knees took all over all those years. His knees were really, really fucked up at the end. And there was one incident in particular in WCW that really, I mean, he suffered a knee injury that I'm not sure he ever really recovered from. It was would have been around 1999, and it's one of those things that you look back on it, and it's totally unnecessary. I mean, you just look at that and go, what the fuck was this guy thinking? There was a cage match. I don't remember, it might have been Hogan versus Savage, or it was some sort of cage match. Hogan was there, and Savage actually climbed to the top of the steel cage and came off the top of the cage, which what I believe would have been a double axe, but he came, I mean, he just came right down on his knees. And I think that's when he hurt his knee. He had to have, I think, reconstructive surgery, and he just was never the same after that. I mean, really, when he went to WCW, he was never the same. He was never as quick. He was never as quite as good as he used to be, and that part of that comes with age. Again, when a lot of those guys went to WCW, Hogan was in his 40s, Savage was in his 40s, Piper was in his 40s. It was a joke. These were guys that clearly had a little bit of gas left in the tank, and they made big bucks with them. But it was the old man's crew that Eric Bischoff brought over from WWF because they wanted to go in a younger direction. And age catches up with all of us, unfortunately, and it caught up with Savage at that point. And he pretty much disappeared after that. And the only other appearance that he made for a major wrestling promotion was in 2004. Savage agreed to come into TNA Wrestling. This would have been back probably when it was still NWA TNA. And Savage came out, and I remember reading how shocked people were, because Savage, who was decked head to toe in all black, I mean, he was wearing a black hat, he was wearing, I think, a long leather black trench coat, black boots, black shades, he was the Johnny Cash of professional wrestling, but he walked out there, and he was so much smaller than people remembered him being. In 2002, Savage was in the very first Spider-Man movie. You know, you may remember him as Bonesaw McGraw. So he would have filmed that probably around 01, right? 2001, around then. If you look at him in that movie, I have never seen Randy Savage as jacked to the gills as he was in that Spider-Man movie. I mean, the guy looked like he was going to explode. And here he was 2 or 3 years later in TNA showing up, looking as small as anybody ever remembers him being. Clearly, he realized that he had to stop doing whatever he was doing. Perhaps, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that perhaps, you know, a doctor told him, listen, you better get off whatever shit you're on because this ain't good for your heart. And so Savage was quite literally a shell of his former self. He made this one appearance in TNA where he came in and he was, you know, he was being Randy Savage. He was being a bit of a diva at this point, and he wanted to be the world champion, and he apparently you know, requested his own locker room, and he just kind of was completely cut off from the rest of the boys, doing his own thing, and it didn't last very long. In fact, I think that was the only appearance Savage made, and they just thought at the time, God, this guy is nuts. He's crazy. Can't deal with him. And that was it. Savage never appeared again for another wrestling company. He kind of fell off the grid at that point, and the only times I had seen Savage in recent years, I saw him 3 times, not in person, but I saw photos of him. I believe he was reading, was it stories around Christmas time to children? It was in a more of a charity capacity, and he had the big bushy white beard. He looked a lot older because he looked like Santa Claus. Most recently, I had gone down to Florida in early March to go down to Mets spring training, and shortly before, maybe the week before I went down there, I think I tweeted a photo to all of you guys that Savage was spotted on television during one of the New York Mets spring training games in Florida. One of the Mets players, might have been Jason Bay, was coming up to the plate, and in the background, in the first few rows of the fans at the ballpark, there was Randy Savage with the big white beard sitting there looking down, playing around with his cell phone. You know, he was a big baseball fan right up until the very end, and yeah, I wonder if you would have asked Randy Savage, if you would have had the choice, looking back on it, would you have become a ball player or a wrestler? It's a weird thing because in wrestling, I mean, look at how big of a star he became. I mean, he died on Friday, and within a couple of hours, this outpouring of support from just all walks of life from all over the world was just staggering, and Savage became a household name. He made millions and millions of dollars and seemingly saved up his money, which is probably why he didn't make too many appearances in recent years. You know, unlike guys like Flair and Hogan, who almost had to go to TNA because of their money issues, Savage didn't have those same issues. But again, would Savage have done baseball over wrestling? I don't know. You know, you read stories about how passionate he was about it. He probably would have picked baseball over wrestling. As a wrestling fan, I'm glad that things worked out the way they did. You know, what happened to Savage is very sad. I don't know that you can blame it on the wrestling business. We'll see what happens when the autopsy comes back, whether he had an enlarged heart. I'm almost positive he must have. But whatever the case may be, a very decorated career, celebrated life, coming to an end in the manner that it did, it really is just a very sad story. And what's even sadder is that here's a guy that had one of the greatest careers in the history of professional wrestling. And we all know the story with the WWE Hall of Fame. You know, it's a marketing ploy. The Hall of Fame exists only in Vince McMahon's head. The bottom line is this. To the people that get that call, you know, to the people who are inducted, to the people who show up at the ceremony in front of their peers and all the fans and all the pomp and circumstance and they get their Hall of Fame ring, to those people, it's a big deal. Even Shawn Michaels said, you know, Shawn Michaels was hanging around with his friends, the Click, and everybody backstage at the Hall of Fame. And I think Sean Waltman had told the story recently in an interview. He said, you know, Shawn acknowledged, you know, that it's just a gimmick, but he couldn't believe how nervous he was. He was really, really nervous before he went out there. And yeah, you know why he's nervous? Because to those guys, it means something to them. It's an acknowledgement that their career was not for nothing. It's an acknowledgement that all the bumps and all the bruises and all the days and weeks and months and years on the road and all the championships and all the bullshit and everything was worth it. It's a validation of one's career. It's a validation of one's successes in the wrestling industry. To them, it means something. And I'm sure that to Randy Savage, it would have meant something just as much. Now, I see where people are saying, well, you can't blame WWE for Savage not being in the Hall of Fame because Savage didn't want to go into the Hall of Fame. Bullshit. I don't know where that rumor started, but Lanny Poffo himself, Randy's brother, who, you know, still talked to Randy and saw Randy on a regular basis, when he's asked that question in recent years, you know, would Savage accept an invite into the Hall of Fame if it were offered? He said, I'm sure he would, absolutely. It was all Vince McMahon's call. If Vince wanted him in the Hall of Fame, believe you me, Savage would have gone into the Hall of Fame. It was not a situation like Bruno Sammartino, for example, who has had an issue with Vince McMahon and an issue with the current wrestling product and does not want to go into the Hall of Fame, and they've made overtures to Bruno over and over and over again, and he just simply flat out refuses. I've never, ever heard that being the case with Savage. The offer, the invitation, was never even made because of whatever beef Vince McMahon had with the man. And to me, it makes me very sad to think that Savage is going to go into the Hall of Fame now. I mean, I am 100% convinced Savage is going into the Hall of Fame. And in fact, it would not shock me if he went in next year. And that's all well and good, and he deserves to be in there, but it'll be 1 year too late if it happens, because it won't be the same without Randy Savage actually being there. To, you know, see him in person, to hear that trademark voice, it would have been something special, and I think it's a moment, quite frankly, that he deserved. He deserved to be there to accept the ring and to soak in the adulation. You know, there's a lot of current guys in the roster who grew up and became wrestlers because of Randy Savage. You know, they were dropping elbows when they were little kids. And unfortunately, as fans were deprived of that moment, as you know, the personality himself, Savage, obviously never had that moment, which I think he deserved. And the question is, what do you do now? You know, WrestleMania next year is in Miami. And to me, there's very little doubt in my mind that The Rock will probably be going into the Hall of Fame next year. It's in his hometown of Miami. He deserves to go in. Somebody like Edge, who of course just retired due to injury, is still a young guy. He doesn't have to go into the Hall of Fame right away. You can wait a year or two to put Edge in the Hall of Fame, and quite frankly, Edge is somebody who deserves a Hall of Fame class all by himself. Not that he's the only one going in, but he deserves to be the headline attraction of a Hall of Fame class. So perhaps in 2013 or 2014, they could do something with Edge. Even if you put Rock in the Hall of Fame next year, I think you absolutely put Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame with him and have Rock and Savage as the two headline attractions, because to me, now that Randy Savage has died and now that he is no longer with us, you cannot have Randy Savage, in my opinion, as the headline attraction for the Hall of Fame without him being there. You know, they've done posthumous inductions of people in the past, Eddie Guerrero, Mr. Perfect, but they've never been the main event. You know, you want the person to be there in the flesh. So being that that's not possible now with Savage, I say just put him in next year. You know, you can put him in. I presume, you know, the genius can be there to either induct him or accept the induction on his behalf, or maybe his wife, Lynn. But the man deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Whether it's a marketing ploy, a joke, or whatever, there is a Hall of Fame, and you put the best of the best in your Hall of Fame. Savage is a very big part of why the WWF became as successful and as powerful as it did in the 1980s. And he deserves that recognition. You know, they came out with a DVD last year called Macho Madness, which was really just a collection of his greatest matches and moments. They didn't bother interviewing him. They didn't bother putting in a documentary feature. You know, it seemed as though the relationship perhaps had been thawing a little bit in recent months with Savage getting his own action figure with Mattel. He was in the WWE All-Stars video game. I mean, it's almost eerie to think that after all these years, we were first now, in 2011, starting to actually see Randy Savage get back involved. I mean, they did that video with him at Comic-Con where, you know, he's on camera holding up his new action figure and pimping it out. And he did a video for the new video game that came out promoting that. And he had a line in there somewhere where he said 2011 is going to be the year of the Macho Man. And as it turned out, 2011 is the year of the Macho Man. But it turned out to be the year of the Macho Man for all the wrong reasons. And if I'm Vince McMahon, I come out on Raw this Monday night in the flesh, and I announce Randy Savage as the first candidate for the 2012 class of the WWE Hall of Fame. You know, if they can announce the WrestleMania main event 1 year in advance, you can announce the first inductee into the Hall of Fame 10 months in advance. There's nothing wrong with that. I think he deserves it. And I for one, am very happy to see that, for the most part, all of the words of support and everything, and all the different TV shows and all the websites, for the most part, you know, there's some people cracking jokes about Slim Jim and all that, but it's been very respectful. Which, again, I think speaks volumes about the impact that this guy had on a lot of people. There's a lot of old wrestling fans who haven't watched wrestling in 15 years who have come out and they've made comments about, you know, my God, I can't believe Randy Savage died. And he was a big part of their childhood. And I can tell you that he was a big part of my childhood as well. And I will always look back on Randy Savage very fondly as a performer. And whenever I pop in a match of his, more often than not, it's the sort of thing that brings a smile to my face. So, rest in peace to the Macho Man. Condolences to his family and friends. And believe it or not, there were other stories this week in the world of wrestling. It's kind of ironic, actually, because only just a couple of days ago, like midweek, I was starting to get a little bit worried because there wasn't a whole lot of news. I didn't quite know what the rundown was going to be for the podcast this week. I thought, man, this is going to be a short show. And if you really stop and think about it, all of the big news of the week really broke within a 36-hour period this weekend. The Savage thing, of course, first broke on Friday morning. Later in the day on Friday, there was some big TNA news. And then just yesterday, there was huge news from Ring of Honor, the de facto number three promotion in the country. I think it's safe to say we could all agree on that. Press release came out announcing that Ring of Honor has been sold to the Sinclair Broadcasting Group. Sinclair has purchased 100% of Ring of Honor, apparently, from owner Kerry Silken. And this is a big deal. This is a very big deal. You know, you can go both ways on the issue. On the one hand, you could say, well, it's good, but it's not that great because Sinclair basically has control over a very limited number of TV stations, and it's not like a Spike TV or an FX or a USA Network or anything like that. On the other hand, Ring of Honor has, you know, they've been doing okay lately, but I got the impression that if things didn't change in some way, especially when they lost TV on HDNet all those months ago, their last broadcast was last month, but the deal with HDNet ended a couple months ago. I got the impression that unless something happened, perhaps Kerry Silken would have closed up shop with Ring of Honor at some point. How much longer would he have gone on as the owner of Ring of Honor, absorbing some losses, making little tiny profits? How much longer did he want to do that? And this will keep Ring of Honor alive for the foreseeable future. And if you're a fan of ROH, and really if you're a fan of pro wrestling, you have to be happy about that. If you look at the top three promotions in the country right now, WWE, TNA, and ROH, to be perfectly honest with you, ROH is the one company. And I'm sure Dragon Gate and Evolve and you know, promotions like that also have great wrestling. But you look at the bigger promotions in the country, and Ring of Honor is probably the greatest like independent that there is right now. And they've had 9 years of history behind them, even more than TNA, or just as much time as TNA. They're really the ones that, if you are a fan of wrestling, old school wrestling, real wrestling, athletic competition, Ring of Honor is the promotion for you. You know, you ain't going to get that very often in WWE or TNA. And so I look at this as a positive move for them. I mean, Sinclair has 22% market penetration. They've got 58 television stations across the country in 35 markets, which is nothing to sneeze at. It's not a lot per se, but, you know, for example, the list of markets in this country, if you live in these markets, chances are that you will have access to Ring of Honor when they're back on TV this fall. They're coming to Tampa, Minneapolis, let's see here, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, Nashville, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, San Antonio, Greenville, Birmingham, Norfolk, Las Vegas, Oklahoma City, Greensboro, Buffalo, Mobile, Alabama, Cape Girardeau, Syracuse, New York, and Charleston, South Carolina. So those are the markets that you could probably expect the ROH television program to be on. I mean, I'm in New York City, and I'm not on that list, which is amazing to think that New York City would not be on that list. But the plan is for the first TV taping to take place in August. I believe it will take place in August in Chicago, and the actual show would not air until late September. So there's still going to be a bit of a delay, much like there was with HDNet. It's not like they're going to tape a show and it's going to air the next week. There's going to be a couple of weeks or as much as a month from the time of the taping to the time that it actually airs on television. They're doing this, I guess, as part of Sinclair's new fall season. Probably be an hour-long show on Saturday nights, which Saturday nights is not the best time slot for a television show, but, you know, TNA, when they first came to Spike, they aired on Saturday nights, and their ratings were not what they are now, but they did well enough to impress Spike to where Spike moved them to Thursdays. So you never know. You just never know. The sale of the company means an increase in power for Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette has been working, I believe, as an executive producer with ROH now for some time, and has been assisting Hunter Johnston with booking. Hunter Johnston, you may know him as the performer Delirious. He took over booking duties in ROH when Adam Pearce got fired. And Cornette has been consulting for the most part on the booking, and he will be working full-time for Ring of Honor going forward. Joe Koff, who works for Sinclair, will be the chief operating officer for ROH. And former WCW promoter Gary Juster, or Juster, I guess, will be the vice president and will oversee all the live event aspects of the company. So one of the benefits of this is they're going to have some money behind them now, not TNA-level money. And it remains to be seen how much financial support Sinclair will give ROH, but there will definitely be an upgrade in TV production values, lighting, stuff like that. Kevin Kelly, former WWF announcer, who has already been the play-by-play guy for many of the Ring of Honor internet pay-per-views, he will assume the role of television play-by-play announcer. So congratulations to Kevin Kelly on that. Apparently there will be a press conference in Baltimore on June 24th, feature a number of ROH staff and talent. They'll announce more of what is included and involved in this deal, and I guess they'll take some questions. So that's coming up on June 24th. So, you know, it's an interesting question going forward whether or not this is a big enough deal where ROH could potentially threaten TNA as the number two promotion in the country. I mean, I still think that's still, you know, far off, because at the end of the day, TNA has a national cable television slot on Spike. And that's something that ROH, it's going to be tough to compete with. But, you know, being bought by a television company and being back on TV is exactly what ROH needs to survive. The bottom line is that without television in 2011, very difficult, if not impossible, to survive. And ROH did very well for itself without TV for many years. And then they got TV. But once you get TV, you can't lose TV, which is what happened. And if you do, it usually spells doom. So this is a positive if you're a Ring of Honor fan, because now ROH is going to be back on the air. And even if you're not in one of those markets, like I'm not in one of those markets, I will be unable to watch their TV show. However, apparently they will be streaming the TV show on their website as well for people who don't have a Sinclair station in their market. And I believe if you live outside of the country, if you are an international fan, you should still be able to go on their website and stream the show. So this will provide greater penetration for ROH. This will provide greater attention for people who want to familiarize themselves with the Ring of Honor product. And if you've never seen a Ring of Honor show before, then I encourage you strongly to check it out, because I think it will be something that you really like. You know, I've been to a whole bunch of ROH live shows. I've slacked off. I haven't been to one in quite some time. And I don't know why, because I don't think I've ever had a bad experience at an ROH show. I've always had fun every time I go. I have been to Ring of Honor shows where I purchased tickets with a friend months in advance, and I almost forget that there's a show coming up. And when I realize that, I got to go to the ROH show on Saturday, sometimes I'm guilty of almost feeling, you know, like, ugh, I got to go to the Ring of Honor show. Why did I buy tickets? I don't know why I feel that way sometimes, and almost like it's an annoyance. But I go to the show, and every single time when the show is over, I say to myself, schmuck, what were you so worried about? I just had the time of my life. It's a lot of fun. And if you have never seen an ROH show, yes, it's not WWE. It doesn't have the same production values as WWE. But it does provide one thing that WWE and God knows TNA is simply incapable of doing, which is great wrestling matches with storylines that consistently and more often than not make sense. It's basic wrestling 101. It's not just straight wrestling. You know, you've got wrestling and you've got entertainment. You know, you've got comedy characters, you've got storylines and you know, turns and stuff like that. But it's done in a way that makes sense, and it's not overdone. And ROH has a benefit in that they don't have weekly TV that they have to, you know, write. You know, I give the writers in WWE credit, because to have to come up with compelling storylines every single week and to work for somebody like Vince McMahon cannot possibly be easy. But ROH consistently delivers a product that makes sense. They consistently deliver wrestling that, quite frankly, you won't find anywhere else. And I heartily endorse them as somebody who's been to their shows before, and I look forward to their TV show coming back. You know, as somebody who never really had a chance to see the HDNet show because I didn't have HDNet, and even though the shows would pop up on YouTube, I just, you know, I just couldn't be bothered to watch. I heard nothing but great things about the HDNet show, and this show will probably be very similar to that one. So big news for ROH this week, and certainly it's a step in the right direction. Sinclair is not, again, it's not in a bunch of different markets. It's Sinclair as a company is actually known to be very conservative and very very right-leaning. And I don't know what that may or may not mean for Ring of Honor, but that, you know, the answer to that question will come later on. The fact is, everybody in the company is very happy with this decision. They think it's going to mean bigger and better things for the promotion. And you know what? God bless, because the more wrestling, the better it is for us as fans. The other big story of the week that I think really got overshadowed by the Macho Man news and even the ROH news to some degree involves TNA. There was a front office shakeup this week, and on Friday, Terry Taylor was fired from Total Nonstop Action. He was the head of the company's talent relations department in a role that is very similar to the one that Jim Ross once filled in WWF. It's currently filled by John Laurinaitis. There was a company-wide statement that got released, and TNA announced that Dean Broadhead, who I've never heard of before, will oversee the contractual end of talent relations, and former WWF executive Bruce Pritchard, who you may know as Brother Love, he's been with TNA for a little while now since he left WWE, and now he will handle Terry Taylor's other duties. So I guess they will kind of share responsibilities in the role of talent relations. So, you know, Terry Taylor had been with TNA since 2003 in a management capacity, so almost from the very beginning. And he's been the head of talent relations for pretty much most of TNA's existence. So it'll be interesting to follow There are sources in TNA that claim that Pritchard is not very well liked by wrestlers in the company. But he did work very closely with Vince McMahon. I mean, he was part of that inner circle for many, many years. And, you know, in talent relations, I don't know that that really means anything. I'm sure if there's any trade secrets, he's probably already shared them with TNA at this point. But this is a big deal because, again, I did a whole podcast, or I should say my top story on the podcast many weeks ago was about the Daphne story and how awful she was treated by TNA management, and she had dealings back and forth with Terry Taylor, including emails that supposedly exist that had indicated that TNA would be taking care of the medical costs that were induced because of injuries that she has sustained on the job. And then, you know, Terry Taylor came back and changed his tune, and it was just a really bad situation that was handled very poorly. And then there were rumors that there was some sort of sexual harassment lawsuit that was either filed or about to be filed against the company. And Terry Taylor was named in the complaint. And, of course, all of this was alleged. I don't even know that it's been confirmed. But then you hear that Terry Taylor, after being with the company for almost the entire existence of TNA, was fired. And it makes you wonder, where there's smoke, there's fire. So there's a lot more to this story than meets the eye. And I'm sure that in the weeks to come, we're going to be hearing a lot more about this. Some other news here. As I record this, it is Sunday afternoon. Tonight is the WWE Over the Limit pay-per-view. And just to run down the card really quick here, John Cena and The Miz will meet in an I Quit match for the WWE Championship. Randy Orton will meet Christian for the World Heavyweight title. The big question here is, will Christian turn heel? Just judging by what I've seen of SmackDown the last couple of weeks since Christian lost the belt, especially last week, I didn't see a lot of the show, but what I did see, Christian's mannerisms and just the way that he's conducting himself, it's almost a guarantee to me that this guy is turning heel. It's just a matter of when at this point. Rey Mysterio and R-Truth will go one-on-one. Of course, this is a match that was not the original plan. Actually, I think Truth and Mysterio were originally going to be paired off in a program heading into SummerSlam. And then John Morrison got hurt, and they bumped Alberto Del Rio from whatever his planned match was. And so we have Truth and Mysterio a couple of months early. And I hope they have a good match, because I want to see more of Truth. And that's something, quite frankly, I never thought I would hear myself say. If they job him out here tonight to Rey Mysterio, then they're just a bunch of morons. I don't know what to say. There's only one outcome to this match that makes sense. Mysterio does not need this victory. R-Truth does. And it's the only way to go. Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and a Kiss My Foot match. Please, God, end this feud. Please. I wouldn't be shocked to see Jack Swagger desert Cole, throw him to the wolves in this match. Lawler needs this victory. Better yet, have Jim Ross come out and make Cole kiss his foot while he's at it. Then you can have all the divas come down, and they could all beat the shit out of Michael Cole also, just because. Big Show and Kane defend the Unified Tag Team titles against Mason Ryan and CM Punk. Wade Barrett defends the Intercontinental Championship against Ezekiel Jackson. Sin Cara will go one-on-one with Chavo Guerrero. Never thought I'd say that, but they've been building a Chavo Guerrero pay-per-view feud very good, very well over the last couple of weeks on SmackDown. And apparently Brie Bella will face Kelly Kelly in a match that I presume will be for the Divas Championship, but I don't know that for sure. I assume there'll be some sort of karma appearance, perhaps, after the match. So there you go. That's your Over the Limit card. Looking back at the week here, Tough Enough from Monday night was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. I was very sad to see Martin get eliminated the way that he did. He hurt his ankle, was unable to continue, suffered a fracture. Christina, who was actually the sister of Alicia Fox, for those of you who don't know, she also suffered an injury at the end of the episode. She was coming off the top rope for, I don't know what she was trying. I guess she was trying a double axe handle, and she just came directly down on her feet and suffered some sort of ankle injury, I believe. So the question now is she too hurt to continue? We didn't get the answer to that question. I guess we'll find out on Monday's episode. But I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to on Monday's episode. I'm looking forward to The Rock. The Rock will make an appearance on Monday's Tough Enough. And apparently James Rodet of USA Network's Psych TV show will also be on Tough Enough. And the only thing I could say to that is, who gives a shit? I mean, really, who gives a shit about James Rodé? I guess his mother probably cares. Mrs. Rodé cares very much about James, but I don't. And apparently the winner is going to be decided. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago it would be on the 13th. Apparently it will be on June 6th. On Raw is when the Tough Enough winner will be announced, and Steve Austin will be on that show, and Austin will also be on the June 13th show at Nassau Coliseum. He'll be on both weeks, so that should be interesting. Superstars this week. You must be asking yourself, why would I be talking about superstars? Tyson Kidd lost in the opener on Superstars this week to Yoshitatsu, one of the more underrated performers in WWE. And Michael Hayes, who had just been paired off with Kidd the week before as his new manager, they just could not help themselves. Michael Hayes proceeded to slap the shit out of Tyson Kidd after the match. So, it's unbelievable. Now, maybe it's just a way for him to toughen Tyson up. This does not mean they're breaking up, per se, but it could very well mean that they're breaking up. And that would be after 1 week of putting them together. So, again, I give you Exhibit A. Actually, I give you Exhibit Z at this point of the fact that people in this company have ADD and they just can't help themselves. Monday Night Raw. I miss Raw for a Mets game I was at on Monday night, and apparently I didn't miss much based on what I read. I haven't even bothered, quite frankly, to go back and watch the show. I probably will at some point, just so I can keep my streak of shows alive where I could say that I've seen every episode of Raw. But I have not yet gone back and watched it, and like I said, I don't really have much of an interest in doing so, so I have nothing more to say about Monday Night Raw. SmackDown, I will just say this one thing. I miss SmackDown as well. The only thing I did see, I went back and watched the end of the show, the end of the main event, because I heard that robot Randy Orton seemingly had some sort of malfunction. And frankly, I still don't know exactly what I saw. I posted an animated GIF image on my Twitter, so go on there and see it if you haven't saw this thing yet. Orton, basically, he wins the match. He delivers an RKO to Mark Henry. And I think he pinned him after that. And Orton immediately pops up after the match and does, it's almost like a cheerleader move. He jumps in the air, does a split in midair to where he touches his toes with each of his hands. So he's just standing there, jumps in the air. Could have injured himself. I don't know how smart that was. And he was doing the worst babyface act that I've ever seen, basically. He's just going nuts like an old-school babyface. The only problem is Randy Orton does not work as an old-school babyface. Randy Orton, at the end of the day, he works better as a heel, or at the very least, as a tweener. And I don't know if this was something that Orton just decided to do on his own. I don't know if this somehow plays into a Christian heel turn, where they're trying to make Orton even more of a babyface than usual, and so the turn will mean more if it happens. I don't know if it's one of those things where they told Randy, listen, we want you to be more of a babyface, so go out there and do this, because if that's what they're doing with him, this is an epic fail. I don't want to see Randy Orton doing that each week. You know, if they want his character to come off as cool, that's not the way to go about doing it. It was funny to see this week, but if I see Randy Orton start kissing babies and slapping hands and doing flips and cartwheels in the ring, yeah, I don't think I'm going to be watching much of SmackDown anymore. Earlier in the week, we had heard that the WWE Bragging Rights pay-per-view that I have just ragged on numerous times on this show, I think I did last week, actually, and lo and behold, they ditched Bragging Rights, and they replaced it with a new pay-per-view by the name of Uprising, which... Rest in peace, Uprising. It only lasted a couple of days. And Uprising has already been replaced by Vengeance. So apparently they're going back to an old pay-per-view name. Vengeance will now take place in October. And the reason that they ditched Bragging Rights is very simple. I looked this up here, and these stats come from The Observer. Last year, the Bragging Rights pay-per-view did only 137,000 buys worldwide, which equaled 71,000 buys domestically. That sucks. That is by far the lowest pay-per-view buy rate domestically that they've gotten, maybe with the exception of that awful ECW December to Dismember show a couple of years ago. But apparently it's the lowest since 1985. That's how badly bragging rights did last year. That's how badly WWE pay-per-views are doing, aside from WrestleMania. So now we get Vengeance in October, and we'll see if it makes a difference. Mysterio and Sin Cara. I read an interesting news bit this week, according to the Wrestling Observer. After the Anaheim Angels got publicity, you may have seen this, earlier in the month, Anaheim Angels are a baseball team, and they got a lot of publicity by breaking the, I believe, Guinness World Record for people wearing masks in the same place at the same time. And apparently WWE saw this, and they want to make a run at that record. They want to try to break the record that the Angels just set. Now, if they do it, they're going to have to do it at WrestleMania when you have about 70,000 people. And right now there's talk, which again means jack shit right now because we're so far away from WrestleMania, but there is talk of doing a one-on-one match between Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara at WrestleMania next year. And the idea has been pitched. With Mysterio's health, by the way, you just never take anything for granted. But that is the plan that they're kind of batting around right now. And if they do it, the idea, I don't know how they would promote it, but they would want to get as many people in that arena, in that building in Miami as possible to wear masks, at least during that one match. And if they could do it, they may set a new Guinness World Record next year. So, you know what? If that's what it takes for us to get a Rey Mysterio-Sin Cara match, I'm all for it. I don't want to see Mysterio and Cara now, but I think if you wait until WrestleMania next year, it's long enough and it's a big enough deal, it's a big enough show where that match could be huge. I mean, absolutely huge. And it could be a great passing of the torch in a way, and a way for Mysterio to put Sin Cara over. So we'll see if that ends up happening. Another note here on Zack Ryder, if you're a Zack Ryder fan, as I am quickly becoming. His video work, apparently, on YouTube has not gone unnoticed behind the scenes in WWE. And usually, when you hear that, that's usually a bad thing. But apparently, it's a good thing. And there were stories a couple of weeks ago that WWE was confiscating signs that people were bringing to their shows. And they weren't obscene in any way. They weren't promoting, TNA or anything like that. They were Zack Ryder signs. And for whatever reason, they were taking these signs away from people, which is usually a bad sign for the wrestler. But apparently they stopped confiscating those signs, and you're seeing more and more of them on TV now. And he is expected to get more TV time going forward. So let's hope so. I mean, that would be almost unprecedented if this whole internet writer revolution, or whatever you want to call it, actually results in a television push. It's just so, it goes in the face, it flies in the face, I should say, of the way WWE usually handles these situations. I am cautiously optimistic about this. You know, Zack Ryder has gone from somebody I really could give two shits about to somebody that decided to take the bull by the horns, to show that he has charisma, to show that he can be entertaining. And it's all, he did it all by himself. If he gets a push out of this, he deserves credit for it in just every conceivable way. And it really is an interesting thing because I said earlier, R-Truth is another example of a guy that I just could not care about. They didn't do anything with him. He came out. His act was stale. He didn't show me anything. And I expected him to be one of the guys that, I would go online one day and read that he got cut from the company. And then they did the heel turn. And he has handled that heel turn better than I ever could have imagined, to the point where I could easily see him and John Cena feuding for the WWE Championship on Raw in a program for a couple of months, and I wouldn't mind it. And Zack Ryder is another example of a mid to lower card guy that WWE did nothing with. And they put him, I don't know if it was his idea or if, I would imagine it probably was Zack Ryder's idea, actually, the whole Long Island broski gimmick that he has going on, but they didn't do anything with him. He was a job guy. And he went and started doing these YouTube videos, and it's really taken off. I mean, these videos are racking up just tens of thousands of views, even more than most of the videos that WWE puts on their own YouTube channel. And, if I'm WWE, one of the things I would do perhaps is start hosting Zack's videos on their YouTube channel, because by doing that, it probably will get a little bit more attention for him. And get this man on TV, absolutely. I don't want to just see him fist pumping with John Cena. The only thing I want to see Zack Ryder doing with John Cena is him beating the shit out of John Cena.
If he's not beating the shit out of John Cena, then I don't want him near John Cena. You know, give him his own talk show segment. You know, it's been a while since we've seen, you know, the highlight reel with Chris Jericho or Carlito's Cabana. You know, Zack Ryder could just as easily have his own segment on Raw. Start airing his videos with better production values on your TV shows. Why not do that? Why not go to him and say, listen, these home videos that you're making are all well and good. Why don't we do the same thing, but we'll do it with our cameras. We'll upgrade the production on these things so we could air them on television. I think it's a fine idea. Quick update on the Pope. A couple TNA stuff here, actually. D'Angelo De Niro, he was on ESPN Radio earlier in the week and said that he is, in fact, not leaving TNA. So that is great news if you are a fan of the Pope. But when you post cryptic messages on your Twitter like he did and you don't bother explaining them when people start freaking out, you're doing it on purpose. You know, I love it when people play it off as, oh, well, you know, I just have to put these rumors to rest. I don't know how these things get started. It's like, really? Because you started them, that's why. He clearly wanted people to think he was leaving. He wanted to create a buzz, and he got it. So, good for him. Desmond Wolfe update. I was very interested when I saw Desmond Wolfe's name floating around. I thought perhaps it was an update on his in-ring comeback, and the update is that there is no update. He is still in limbo, whatever the issue, the medical issue is with him. Nobody's talking. There's been a lot of speculation about what it might be, and it's just speculation at this point. I think I know what it is. I'm not going to talk about that, but needless to say, he's not going to be wrestling anytime soon, if that is the case. And he did return to the Impact tapings on Monday. His new role is the commissioner of TNA's Explosion series. So Desmond Wolfe is the commissioner of TNA Explosion. Yeah. Also at the tapings, TNA started a tournament for the new Explosion Championship with the idea that the champion would be able to challenge any champion on Impact, almost like the Money in the Bank concept, I guess. And or you know, at least the early days of NXT. If you won NXT, you earned yourself a title shot. And anyway, in the opening match of the tournament, Pope beat Suicide. So, whatever, you know, Explosion is one of those secondary throwaway shows, and, you know, they want to try to make something happen with it, so, you know, whatever. Impact Wrestling. Let's talk a little bit of Impact Wrestling here. Does wrestling really matter? That was the question. TNA, of course, has rebranded its TV show from Impact to Impact Wrestling. For now, they're still a company known as TNA. Although that could change at some point. I know there's people like Hogan and Bischoff who desperately want the TNA name to just be dropped into the bottom of the ocean. And here's the thing. I did not see all of Impact, but I did go back to watch parts of the show because I, like many of you, were morbidly curious as to what differences we may see on the TV show. Would the set look different? Would the actual layout of the show be different? Would we, in fact, see more wrestling and less bullshit? And they changed the logo. They changed little things. You know, they changed the logo of the show, and they have blue lighting now, and it looks nice and all that, and that's all well and good. But at the end of the day, you have 9 segments on this TV show this week. Okay, your first week where you push Wrestling Matters as your tagline. And you have 9 segments on the show, 4 of which are talking segments. And of the 5 wrestling segments, one of them features a non-wrestler, and another one goes less than 60 seconds. So, basically, at the end of the day, Impact on Thursday was the same Impact that we always see. And, you know, you got to give it a couple of weeks to see if it really does change for the better. This was only week 1. But if week 1 is any indication and you have Abyss winning the X Division title, if week 1 is any indication, then, you know, you can't be surprised by this. I mean, did you really think that TNA was going to... Look, here's the thing. TNA could rebrand itself. It could change the TNA name. You know, TNA could go from TNA to some other 3 initials. It doesn't matter. When I read that Vince Russo was still writing the TV shows, and Eric Bischoff is still there, and Hulk Hogan is still there, and nothing, you know, Dixie Carter is still the president, it's not like anything behind the scenes really changed. They just want to put a different product out on TV, and that's all well and good, and God knows they need to do that. But you have the same people in power. You have the same person writing the same fucking TV show. I mean, it's not like Vince Russo woke up one night and had this epiphany, this great epiphany that, wow, I see wrestling now for what it really needs to be. I think I'm going to change. No! He doesn't understand the concept of change. The only thing Vince Russo knows is what Vince Russo has been doing since the mid-1990s, and that just doesn't work anymore. So to me, until that changes, nothing else is going to change. And, yeah, that's really... I don't have anything else to say about it. I just, you know, it is what it is, and Impact is going to continue to be Impact until either the company dies or they just decide that they need to put some new people with new, fresh ideas in charge in that company. And it doesn't have to be Paul Heyman. It doesn't have to be Jim Cornette. It doesn't have to be Dutch Mantel. They're all great wrestling minds, some of whom at one point have worked for TNA. It could be somebody completely different. But preferably, it needs to be somebody with a background in wrestling. It has to be somebody that knows what they're doing. And I just don't get the impression that there's a fucking person backstage anywhere in TNA that knows what they're doing. TNA and AAA have entered into some sort of partnership here, a working agreement with each other. And as part of that working agreement here, this is kind of big news, so I have to mention it. AAA, which is one of the big native promotions down in Mexico, it's been around for a long time. They have their version of WrestleMania coming up next month. It's Triple Mania 19, which is scheduled for June 18th at the Sports Palace, or the Palacio de los Deportes in Mexico City. Some of the matches on the show, Jeff Jarrett will wrestle El Zorro for the AAA World Heavyweight Championship. Rob Van Dam will face Dr. Wagner Jr. for the Latin American Championship. Mr. Anderson and Abyss will team with, will wrestle, I should say, Jack Evans and Extreme Tiger for the AAA World Tag Team titles. Have some women's action. Mickey James, Velvet Sky, Angelina Love, and Sexy Star will team up to take on Mary Apache, Fabi Apache, Cynthia Moreno, and Lolita. And Triple H has also announced that El Macias, who some of you may remember as Judas Macias from his brief time in TNA many years ago, he'll take on L.A. Park, the former La Parca from the WCW days, in a hair versus mask match. And those hair and mask matches in Mexico are still a very, very big deal. And, going to be a big show. Hopefully the TNA guys will step up and have a good showing for themselves. And it's always nice to have some sort of working... WWE actually had a working agreement with the old SWS promotion in Japan. This would have been around 1990 or so. And they actually had talent like LOD and Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart wrestling on shows in Japan. I don't think you'd ever see WWE enter into some sort of agreement like that today. But for the fans, it's a cool thing. It's, you know, some dream matches that you never thought you'd get to see. And Triple Mania, we'll have some of that on June 18th. So there you go. Just two more quick notes here before we get to the mailbag. Just have to mention this. Yesterday, May 21st, I believe was the day, actually marked the 10-year anniversary, if you could believe it. It's been 10 years since that awesome, awesome, awesome tag team title match on Raw, where Steve Austin and Triple H lost the belts to Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit. That was the match where Triple H tore his quad for the very first time, which was a big deal, big event in WWE history. And he was out for 8 months, came back as a babyface the following year. And it's a shame that that match is seemingly, has been erased from the record books because of Benoit's involvement. But I, for one, will always remember that as being one of the greatest matches in the history of Monday Night Raw. Just a fantastic tag team championship match on every level. And the other anniversary is kind of a sad anniversary. This week will mark the, 99, so I guess that would be the, 12-year anniversary this week of the death of Owen Hart. It was on May 23rd, I believe, in 1999 in Kansas City that Owen fell from the ceiling during the Over the Edge pay-per-view. He was slated for an Intercontinental Championship match as the Blue Blazer against the Godfather, and and there was a malfunction of some kind. He fell a long distance from the ceiling and basically died in the ring. And it was just a terrible, terrible situation. And the very next night on Raw was the Owen Hart tribute show. It was the only the second show of its kind. Second tribute show that I can remember WWE doing. The first tribute show that they ever did, which really wasn't even a tribute show, to be honest with you. So actually, the Owen, I was going to say Brian Pillman, but the Pillman Raw, where they kind of saluted him at the beginning, it was basically just a beginning of the show acknowledgement of his death, and they did a 10-bell salute, but the show itself was not dedicated to Pillman. So Owen really was the first superstar to pass away, who got the tribute treatment, if you will, where the entire show was a dedication to the life and the career of Owen Hart. And I guess Eddie Guerrero probably would have been the second. But again, I remember that Owen Hart run. I have it on tape somewhere, like it was yesterday. And a lot of very upset people. I remember, I think it was Road Dogg maybe and Godfather who were going to have a match. And instead of having a match, they just kind of grabbed the mic and they said, "Look, man, we don't need to do this. Let's go have a beer and celebrate, you know, Owen Hart and tell Owen stories." And they just kind of walked off. And I thought that was kind of nice. And they had Steve Austin come out at the end of Raw. He had just lost the championship the night before in the main event to The Undertaker. And Austin came out. And again, Austin was not on good terms with Owen Hart when Owen passed away. He still harbored some ill feelings towards Owen after Owen dropped him on his head years earlier at SummerSlam. And Owen never bothered to call and apologize and check up on Steve. And I know that really bothered him. And I think even Brett has told stories about how he told Owen, even Brett told Owen that, you know, that wasn't the right thing to do. And so Steve Austin may not have been really good friends with Owen, but he went out there and as the face of the company and the top star at the time, he had the responsibility to go out there and perform a toast to Owen Hart at the end of the show. Cracked open a beer and said a few words under his breath. And that was it. So 12 years ago this week, the death of Owen Hart. It's hard to believe it's been that long. And certainly Owen is somebody who is gone, but definitely not forgotten. All right, so we're going to have a mailbag here, although I apologize. It's going to be a somewhat abbreviated mailbag because I went a little long on the Randy Savage stuff. Again, I 3 days ago, I didn't have much of a rundown for the show this week. I probably would have done a huge mailbag, but a lot of shit happened at the end of the week, unfortunately. The one thing I want to start off with here, I got a letter, just one, but I got a letter from somebody who was asking about Brock Lesnar's condition. I mentioned Brock Lesnar, of course, is out of his UFC fight next month. He suffered a second bout with diverticulitis, which is a disease that is not very pleasant. And his career is potentially hanging in jeopardy. It's in jeopardy right now because is he going to have the surgery that he needs to correct the condition, or is he just going to just try to rehab it? That is really the big question right now. I don't think Brock has made up his mind about what he's going to do. But this person who emailed me, Brad, was wondering if the diverticulitis that Brock is suffering from is the same thing that Vince McMahon had years ago, because Vince himself had a bout of diverticulitis. And again, unless it's corrected by surgery, which is potentially life-changing surgery, it could come back. Even for Vince, it could come back. And so I had gotten another email from one of our longtime listeners, Bill Mitchell, who many of you also may know from the comment sections on SEScoops.com. And apparently Bill has his own stories to share when it comes to diverticulitis and dealing with intestinal issues. And he was kind enough to record just a quick audio testimonial here. So these are the words of Bill Mitchell, one of the fans of the Sound Off, which should give you a little bit of insight into what Brock Lesnar is going through right now.
This is in response to episode 159. I believe Solar Monster was talking a little bit about Brock Lesnar's health issues. And I wanted to share my story about something that I've had to go through because I have had a similar health ailment. My story is a little bit different. In 2001, went out with some friends, went to an amusement park, had a great time, had a couple of beers, ate a couple of hot dogs, came home, and of course, when I got home, I wasn't feeling too well. I had a kind of a stomach ache kind of feeling going on, and I dismissed it, thought it was just something that I ate, I'd get over it. A couple of hours later, I was in severe pain, and it was so much of an intense pain that and I don't encourage anybody to do this, but I went ahead and took the risk of going out and actually going to a pharmacy, picking up some over-the-counter medication that causes drowsiness, just something that allowed me to go to sleep, because I was in so much pain, I couldn't get any sleep. Came back home, popped a few pills, down it with some water, finally went to sleep. The next morning I woke up, I was even in more pain, and when I woke up, my stomach, I literally looked like I had grown a beer belly overnight, and that's when I realized something was seriously wrong. Went to the hospital, got checked out, had some tests done. They found an intestinal blockage. They had to go in and surgically, the first time back in 2001, they had to surgically go in and take care of some scar tissue that built up because I've had numerous abdominal surgeries. But that, unfortunately, did not cure the problem because the problem flared back up in 2008. I had to have what's called an ileostomy put in. The blockage reoccurred, and instead of going in and doing what they did back in 2001, they opted just to go in and have that life-changing surgery. And an ileostomy is a life-changing surgery. I can't speak for Brock's case because I'm not intimately familiar with what's going on health-wise, but there are two types of major surgery one could have with a problem like this. One being the ileostomy, which I had, and a colostomy, which most people are familiar with. The colostomy, of course, is when they take a good portion of the colon, or the colon in its entirety, out of the system, and you have to wear a bag. An ileostomy, kind of like the same thing, except what they do is they take a small portion of the intestine, they bring it up to the skin, and you still have to wear the bag, and it's one of those things that that just you have to do, you know. And I can safely say this, that if he has either those two surgeries, which I think is his biggest fear right now, his combat career is over. There's likely not a chance that he'll be able to get licensed in any combat sport to entertain the fans inside a ring, whether it be MMA, professional wrestling, or whatever. And that's because when you have something like this, you become a biohazard to not only the referee and the competitor, but the fans as well. That would be unfortunate if that's the case with Brock.
There you go. I want to thank Bill for sending that in. That was really cool of him. And again, hopefully, you know, all the best for Brock Lesnar, who, you know, is going through a tough time right now, and he's got a very big decision to make, and hopefully whatever decision he makes is the one that is in his own best interest, and we could see him back in, well, either in the octagon or the wrestling ring at some point. Let's get into some other stuff here. I don't really have a lot of time to get into questions so much as I do. I want to just get some more of these stories out of the way that you guys have been sending me. I've got a whole bunch of them, and again, it's going to take me a couple of weeks, I think, to get through most of them on the air. I can't get to all of them, but they've been really, really great. And so by all means, if you have not yet emailed me, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com with a quick story, keep it short if you can, if you want to get it on the air, about how and when you became a fan of professional wrestling. And for that matter, in light of the sad news this week, if you have any memories of Randy Macho Man Savage that you want to share, anybody out there who is a Macho Man fan, who grew up on Macho Man, has a favorite Macho Man either match or moment or angle. I don't need you to email me links to promos and stuff. I've already seen most of them. But if you have anything like that that you want to share, by all means, email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. All right, let's get back to some of your stories here. Prince, from all the way from Bahrain, writes in. He's a little kid. He was born in the 80s and had the Hulk Hogan plush pillow thing and all that. But he can say that his earliest wrestling memory was in the early 90s, maybe around 92 or 93, watching WCW Saturday Night on TBS. He remembers being a huge fan, looking at the Dungeon of Doom and old school DDP. But more than all of them, it was old school Sting that truly caught his attention. That would have been Surfer Sting, I guess. So you can honestly say that on Saturday nights at 6 o'clock, He used to sit in front of the TV and wait for that intro and wait for the wrestler known as Sting to walk out through those mechanical doors. That's right, those doors that opened up. I always thought that was really cool, actually, the old WCW Saturday Night intro and the theme music. I actually thought that was really cool stuff. I've actually tried looking on YouTube, believe it or not, for just like a 30-second clip or a minute-long clip of the old WCW Saturday Night intro from start to finish with that theme music, and I can't find it. So if anybody knows where I can find it, perhaps you can clue me in on that. Anyway, Prince talks about SummerSlam 98 as well, Highway to Hell, and talking about it at school the next day with his friends. So anyway, that's how he became a wrestling fan, and I'm just going to give a quick shout-out here to his friend Richard, who apparently listens to the podcast, and his friend Antonio, who's actually trying to become a wrestler right now. So good luck to the two of them, or good luck to Antonio, I guess. Ryan L. writes into the Sound Off, listener since 145. Not sure the exact age that he became a WWF fan. It was either the late 80s or the very early 90s. He's probably about 8 or 10 years old at the time. He knows that SummerSlam 1991 was the first pay-per-view that he watched live on pay-per-view. Probably why it's still his favorite. As I mentioned, it was my favorite in Sound Off 158. And Ryan was a fan way back before 91, back when pay-per-views were $30. Those were the days. He used to sleep over at his friend's house, and he was a wrestling fan, and we would watch all sorts of WWF videotapes and old-school pay-per-views. I remember watching old WrestleManias and Survivor Series and SummerSlams and just getting hooked. And then we would practice moves on a mattress and stage matches in the basement, fake WWF title belt and all. During high school, I got out of wrestling and then back into it in college during the Attitude Era. And as a little bit of a trivia note, I was at the Raw show in Hartford, Connecticut, when they announced the change from WWF to WWE. So there you go. Thank you, Ryan. This one comes from Hunter, not the one that you're thinking of. Dear Solomonster, I thought that I would write you and tell you that I first became a wrestling fan when I discovered the Sound Off. No, I'm just kidding. I first became a fan of the episode of Thursday Night SmackDown right before WrestleMania 20. I can distinctly remember believing that Kurt Angle had really gotten the late, great Eddie Guerrero. I have no idea why this got me hooked, but it did. Well, Kurt Angle and Eddie Guerrero were pretty goddamn great, so I don't think it's all that much of a shock that those two guys would help hook you into pro wrestling. Jesse from Converse, Texas writes in, my first wrestling memory, or at least the one I think made me a fan, was Piper's Pit, where Andre challenged Hulk Hogan to a match at WrestleMania and tore off his crucifix. I think I was 7 years old at the time. There was nothing bigger than that. I didn't get to watch pay-per-views back then and had to settle for Superstars and primetime wrestling in the occasional main event special. That was a pretty big deal back then, actually, when Andre ripped off the crucifix and Hogan's shirt and threw it on the ground, and that, of course, led to what would be one of the biggest matches in the history of professional wrestling. Miguel from Puerto Rico writes in, Dear Solomonster, I've been hooked around since episode 140, when I discovered the Sound Off. I've listened to every show available on iTunes, which, by the way, is a very good idea. In case I haven't mentioned that a million times before, you can subscribe to this very show on iTunes. Anyway, let's see here. Miguel says that he was a huge fan of the old WWF Sunday Night Heat live episodes that aired on MTV. They used to have in-ring segments with the superstars that were on the pay-per-view, and it hyped the pay-per-view to make fans want to buy it. What a concept. I remember watching the live edition of Heat before the 1999 King of the Ring, which featured the main event of Rock vs. Undertaker for the WWF Championship. Well, in a little bit of a correction there. It was the championship match, yes, but the main event of that show was actually the ladder match, where Vince and Shane McMahon challenged Steve Austin for control of the company. That was the pay-per-view that pissed me off, because it went off the air at 10:27 p.m. I paid for a 3-hour pay-per-view show, goddammit, and they went off the air earlier than I ever remember them going off the air. Even at the Survivor Series in 97, when all the Montreal stuff happened, and they went off the air early. At least they went off the air at like 9:37. I think it was 9:37, back when the pay-per-views were still starting at 7 o'clock, and then eventually they pushed it back to 8. But anyway, that was just a little... went off on a little tangent. Anyway... Miguel says that during this segment, The Rock was in the ring doing a promo on Undertaker, and all of a sudden, Taker's music hit, and he shows up on the Titantron. He did a kick-ass promo, and as this is happening, a huge Brahma Bull sign comes down and gets lit up in flames at the end of the segment. And I remember Michael Cole saying that The Rock win the WWF Championship tonight, or will his shot go up in flames? Anyway, this show made me want to buy the pay-per-view that night. Well, one of the few times that anything out of Michael Cole's mouth would ever make you want to buy a pay-per-view show, because I can't possibly imagine in 2011 that Michael Cole's announcing makes anybody want to do anything except change the channel. And the funny thing about that, actually, is I met The Rock the day before the King of the Ring that year, actually. It was the day before the King of the Ring 99, and The Rock came to one of the car dealerships here in New York. And a friend of mine, her mother, worked at that car dealership. So we were able to get in there. We didn't have to wait in line. And what we did have to do was we had to wait. Just kind of stupid. We had to wait for The Rock to sign autographs and take pictures with everybody else. And then he kind of came over and came to us for a few minutes. So we didn't have to wait in line. We were literally standing right next to him, like off to the side, just watching. And then we got to meet The Rock, so pretty cool stuff. Akash writes in, he became a big fan in 1998-99. At the time, he and his family lived in an apartment in Queens here in New York, and almost every night after my father got off work, he would rent some old WWF tapes, and we would just watch anything that had to do with The Rock. I was around 4, and he immediately became my favorite. As a matter of fact, back then, my mom shot a lot of home videos of me and my siblings, and in almost every single one of them, I would say the classic, "Do you smell what The Rock is cooking?" phrase. Luckily, I grew up during the most exciting era in wrestling ever. Well, hard to argue that. There's a lot of good and a lot of bad about the Attitude Era, but I think the one thing we can all agree on, it was an exciting time during those Monday Night Wars to be a fan of pro wrestling. Brian writes in, or Slim, from the comments section of SE Scoops. Dear Solid Monster, longtime fan, first time writing in. To answer your question about when I became a wrestling fan, well, my father was a big wrestling fan, and I never really got into it until one day my dad ordered a pay-per-view, and it was the pay-per-view where Eddie Guerrero won the WWE Championship for the first time. That would have been No Way Out. He wasn't able to be there to watch it, so he asked me to sit and watch and tell him what happened. I wasn't happy about having to do that, but I remember after sitting there watching it, you couldn't get me to get up from the, from the couch. I was hooked. So there you go. Brian was hooked by Eddie Guerrero's first championship victory, which was actually a really emotional deal. Watching him win the title when nobody, I think, ever could have predicted that Eddie Guerrero would become WWE champion and beat Brock Lesnar, of all people. And to do it, I think it was in San Francisco at the Cow Palace. Big Latino population there. And the place went nuts. It was really a great moment. And again, not hard to believe that that would be the moment to hook you into being a wrestling fan. And let's do one more here. This comes from Blue Ink. Did not include his real name, but I know he's one of my followers on Twitter. He writes in, he doesn't remember exactly when he became a fan of wrestling because he was so young, but he says, "I'm now 5 months away from turning 26, and I remember every night when wrestling was on, my grandfather and I would get together early in the day and just eat hot dogs all day. Those were my most favorite days of the week. My grandfather passed away back in 2004 after a stroke while I was in high school, and I watched wrestling to reminisce about my times with him, but boy, oh boy, how times have changed. P.S. Your show is to me what cookies are to the Cookie Monster. It's some really good stuff." Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And that's going to do it for the mailbag this week, because, again, I got a ton of stuff, and I can't get to everything this week. We're going to do more stories, more questions next week. Keep sending them in, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I did take the time this week to respond to a whole bunch of people directly. I answered a whole shitload of emails. So, again, I read everything you guys send me, and I try to get to as much of it as I can. You keep emailing me, and I'll keep plugging away. Hit me up on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster, and facebook.com/thesolemonster. A lot of great Randy Savage stories and posts on there. People were posting videos and stuff. One thing about the videos, by the way, and anytime somebody passes away or something happens, it's kind of a habit where people want to share videos, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with sharing videos, but sometimes the wall will get a little too cluttered. I got some emails from people who were complaining about it this week, so just try to ease up on the videos and do more actual posts. But there was a lot of good stuff, a lot of memories shared on Facebook from longtime fans of wrestling and Randy Savage, and get on there. It's just a really good time, a really good little community we got going on, facebook.com/thesolemonster. Don't forget that if you are in the Brooklyn, New York area, next Saturday, May 28th, WUW, the World of Unpredictable Wrestling, will present its May Day in May show. So that's coming up next Saturday, I believe, bell time, 7:30 p.m. from the world-famous Gleason's Gym in Brooklyn, New York. So that's going to do it for 160 this week. Thank you for letting me share my own memories of the Macho Man, and hopefully, you know, hopefully it was somewhat therapeutic. I know there's a lot of very sad people in light of the tragic news from Friday, and it felt good to go back and just kind of remind myself about how great Randy Savage really was as a performer when you look back at the body of work over his entire career from pre-WWF to post-WWF. He was a one-of-a-kind performer who will not soon be forgotten. And I, for one, am looking forward to seeing whatever tribute WWE puts together for him. They did put a video up on their website. I would imagine, though, that they are putting something a little bit more expansive together for their TV shows this week. I don't know if anything will air at the Over the Limit pay-per-view tonight, but there was at least some discussion about not only showing a video in his honor on TV this week, but possibly even having Vince McMahon address the passing of Randy Savage. And like I said earlier, I cannot think of a better way to honor his memory than having Vince come out and announce him as the first candidate for the Hall of Fame class of 2012. But regardless, we will all miss the Macho Man. So on that note, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on scoops.com.